Hello and welcome to Ladies with Gumption, episode 71. I always feel like someone's watching me. I
always feel Tatiana. Like somebody's watching me.
Yes, okay. I'm feeling in it.
Thank you. That was beautiful. and that was Jessica.
Yes.
She's like, once we more, but have... with feeling.
And we also have our host.
Oh, May.
Yep, that's our host. And together, we are the Ladies with Gumption. We recap DCTV in a flash. You can find us at DCTV Gumption on Twitter, or at Ladies W Gumption on Tumblr, or ladieswgumption@gmail.com. And you can find our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and now Spotify!
Woohoo!
Yay! And also Facebook.
The ignored child.
Yes. We also started a Patreon. That soon will have something other than us. but you can check it out at www.patreon.com/DCTVGumption if you want to feed us.
Yes. If you like a thing, you know it, send us cash. If you like a thing, you know it, send us cash.
Yeah, send us cash.
Oh, and to those who've already signed up, we love you, we appreciate you, and we send you virtual hugs.
That's what we can.
By non-virtual things.
Yes.
Anyway. Other things.
Thank you guys so much for the support. We really, really, really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were surprised that anyone was like, I agree. So, thank you guys. For agreeing. We've got some news to discuss, such as DC Superhero Girls getting their first trailer. And I know that certain people are more invested than other people. So would the person who's most invested like to talk about this?
Wow. Okay.
Well, put you on the spot.
So when they first started, like, with the, I guess, the pictures of what the new girls look like, and Bumblebee is, like, significantly lighter in this version. Her eyes are green. Like, she looks like a completely different character. And I had an issue with that. And I was saying, like, why is she a completely different character, basically? Why did, like, changing from one style to the other, you had to, like, lighten her up significantly? Because she's pretty iconically a dark-skinned superhero. And there's not very many of those. And then this one girl on Twitter tried to, like, well, actually, me, and, like, all this kind of stuff. And I wound up having to block her because I'm like, I'm not just going to go back and forth in this, like, endless circle of why she's always been dark-skinned black girl and why that's important and all that kind of stuff. And then, like, the actual trailer came out for the entire show. And on the villain side, the Gotham City Sirens, they actually do have an Afro-Latina Catwoman, which is great, and she's also dark-skinned, which, because, like, the girl on Twitter, she's like, well, actually, they're doing a pastel palette, so all the colors have to be lighter, kind of thing. But
that's a bullshit excuse.
You see a navy blue suit, like, in the first 20 seconds of the trailer, so clearly,
right.
Whatever. Yeah.
So clearly they can do whatever they want. So, and the fact, you know, the good that they did, like, the Afro-Latina Catwoman, I thought that was good, but it just goes to show that they could have also had Bumblebee be darker skinned than she is in the trailer. And so that's it's not the only thing that's, like, throwing me off about the trailer, because I just like the older style that was on YouTube, and I don't see why they had to change that. But it is one of the things that just kind of, like, you know, grinds my gears a little bit. But
yeah, I mean, it looks basically like Bumblebee has a tan. I don't know, it's kind of, it is definitely weird. Like, I was like, wait, what? But, overall, I don't know. I don't really get a feeling of the characters from the series trailer. And especially because it's going to be kind of like a reboot, right?
Yeah, like a soft reboot, I think.
Yeah. So, I don't know.
And this one is definitely centering the trinity of Diana, Kara, and Barbara as the three main, and then everyone else is, like, backup, like, solidly backup. Whereas,
which is funny, because they said that they were going to not do that.
Right. But that's what it looks like. Barbara intros, does the intro to the show, and it's about her and her two friends, Diana and Kara, and all of their other little friends in the background kind of thing. So already it's like, you know, YouTube, it was more, I think you had, they introduced like one of the Trinity each of the seasons, but it was still more, I think, evenly spread out as far as the girls and the, especially like the five that they started with. And then they just kept adding on to it. But this one, it just seems more like these three up front and the rest of these in the background over here.
So, well, all right. Regardless of how you feel about it, the it's premiere, yes, the premiere of Jessie's Weird Girls is first going to be a 1-hour film. I think that's Sweet Justice or Sweet Vengeance, something like that. Sweet Justice, yes. And that'll be March 8th on Cartoon Network. And then the actual show will start March 17th at 4 p.m. Eastern. So be on the lookout for that if that's something that you want in your life. Okay, now we will head on to feedback. So first we'll start with Shang. Lovely, lovely Shang, who sent us some long feedback, but that's all right. Anything that we don't say out loud here, we will put on our Tumblr, ladieswgumption.tumblr.com, so y'all can read in full, and if you want to add on your own comments, feel free to reply, reblog, whatever you want to do. Okay, so he says that Gotham City Sirens was meant to be released in 2020, but they dropped the idea after Margot Robbie prioritized her, after Margot Robbie's solo movie turned into Birds of Prey, which makes sense, because we know we had heard about it, and then suddenly they switched the conversation.
Yeah, like, I feel like that was a thing that had happened and then stopped happening, and I just forgot, but yeah.
But yeah, he says the Suicide Squad director talked about Birds of Prey versus Gotham City Sirens, but because Suicide Squad didn't get the reception WB wanted, and since James Gunn is coming as the director of Suicide Squad 2, Gotham City Sirens was dropped. I guess it would have been a David Ayer production.
That also makes sense. Like, since Suicide Squad didn't do very well, they didn't want to do like another villain team up with Gotham City Sirens. So
exactly. He wants to know how we feel about the how do we feel streaming services is the new upcoming media of today?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, yeah. I'm actually frustrated because I have to keep subscribing to new services. DC has their own streaming, CW has their own app, and then Marvel-related shows means the Disney streaming app. Plus, we just learned that Warner Brothers exactly are going to have their own streaming app and potentially take off old Warner Brothers shows and the new CW shows off Netflix, which is ridiculous.
Yeah,
I'm tired. Please stop. So yeah, he says I might just have to watch them, you know, other ways. Because they don't have
you. Why they don't see this? Like, why do you not see that this is exactly what's going to happen? You can't stretch people like 15 different ways and expect us to pay 15 different streaming services.
It's going
to
be like become the new type of cable, but cable still exists and those channels still exist.
And the whole cutting the cord thing is going the opposite way. Like, people used to be cutting the cord, right? So you get less and less cable subscribers, and now people are going back to cable because there's too many streaming services. Do you have one?
Yeah.
It's like he says, I've seen some discourse within the West Allen and Felicity fandom regarding Felicity's pregnancy. What do you think of it? As I have a bias towards West Allen, I'm not going to lie that I don't feel some sort of way that Felicity's pregnant too. I just don't want this huge crossover to be a Felicity pregnancy drama. Stealing the limelight of West Allen's wedding isn't enough. Since the timeline hasn't changed, I'm presuming Iris is also going to get pregnant with the twins as well. The Flash has always been building up towards Crisis, and I don't want Felicity drama to push what the main story of Crisis is meant to be. I guess the Arrow writers constantly copying ideas from the Flash main couple just rubs me the wrong way quite a lot. I want Crisis to be about Barry and Team Flash the most because it's what their whole show is, the newspaper, and I'm going to be upset when Oliver takes all the credit and jabs. And then he uses the young one, the Monster X young one gif, reaction gif, which is very cool. Anyway, I relate to this. Okay. We'll probably talk about this in our predictions.
Let's talk about this in my Arrow predictions. Exactly. So,
you'll get our response. Shang. Yeah. On Flash related news, unpopular opinion, but I really like Nora. So everyone back off my literal child, please. She's trying. Aw. No problematic. She's doing her best. She's doing her best. I really like the Cisco Nora bonding moment. I finally felt as though Cisco is back in the group. I really thought they would defeat Cicada this episode. We all thought. But I guess they can't because Barry isn't around. Nora could have just... Oh, that's so true. That would have been hilarious if they defeated Barry. Or sorry, defeated Cicada and Barry wasn't even like in the episode. He just came
well,
back.
Well, like, I'll mention this in my dislikes, but there could have been a way, and I will tell you how.
Okay. All right, anyway. Nora could have just placed the metadampening cops in Cicada when he was down. Why doesn't anyone use those? This whole plot hole could have been avoided if Nora untied Iris fast enough. The dagger took 15 seconds to come back. If Nora was in the flash time, she could untie Iris and bring her out of there within 5 seconds. This could actually have been a great episode for Team Flash to finally defeat Cicada and have the filler for Grodd versus King Shark, then Thawne reveal in episode 16. You are right, but they finally ends with the writers turn Cicada into a mashed potato. Yes, they did. All right. Then we've got, of course, our Arrow correspondent, Tasha, with 713 feelings. Hi, ladies. We're in the mid-season slump, but I've enjoyed how they've managed to put a new filter on the last few episodes. That's true. Even though they use every slasher movie trope known to man, from the broken light to the clapping monkey, the horror aspects of the episode were enjoyable. What really shone was the acting. Brendan Fletcher's portrayal of Stan the Fan. Unraveling was impressive. In one episode, Stan outsold a whole season of Diaz.
Yes. Basically.
That being said, the line of the night was definitely, God, no, I'm gay and she's my mom. The level of ew. In Ben Lewis's line delivery was priceless. She liked Aunt Dinah and Zoe fight training. Bunch of iterations of the comics for Black Canary's a surrogate mom and mentor, so it's nice to see that here, just like Sarah and Sin. I haven't enjoyed Curtis.
Tati's in her feelings.
Since season 5. Don't mind me. I haven't enjoyed Curtis in season 5 because they never really explored him as an individual. But I'm glad they managed to subvert my expectation by not killing the only Black gay character. You and me both. Curtis didn't waver on his morals. Plus, both actor and character got to leave for better opportunities. Mm-hmm. But she expects to see Curtis back for Crisis. Yeah, makes sense. Smoke tech is rising, with Curtis signing over Helix Felicity, and once again honing on her security system, and the Archer program in the flash forwards, I see her storyline coming together. Felicity's having a baby. We all knew this because Dave Ramsey spoiled it at Comic-Con, that's correct. And he spoiled that it was happening in his episode, so. I knew that if Mia was anyone's child, she would be theirs. Lots of hints in her first appearance. Blackstar's underground fight in 708 was exactly like Oliver's brought to fight in 501. They focus on Mia, Oliver, and William all drinking scotch. They zoomed in her tattoos, and the only other character whose tattoos are significant is Oliver. But the main hint...
This is why we need Tasha, because she is the only one that would pick up on all of these little things. Like, I was reading, I was like, oh my god!
Yeah.
I didn't even know.
The main hint was this transition from Lucy in bed celebrating their anniversary to William seeing Mia for the first time. That's... I guess that is the main hint. Well, there we go.
That's probably when she was conceived, whatever that was.
Yeah, exactly, right? That's when she was conceived. So there we go. And the storyline of William and Mia meeting as adults is the perfect parallel to Oliver and Amico. That is very true. I did like that. Dislikes. Dinah getting her throat slashed. Besides the obvious reason, this was problematic because I knew she would survive, so there was no tension in the scene. I don't think she should have been revealed in the flash forwards until this episode. True. Because then we wouldn't have known that it was happening. All the information she gave William could have been, he could have easily learned from Zoe while they kept Dinah's fate a mystery.
True, true, true.
Like they did with Curtis. We were constantly worried about Curtis dying because he hadn't shown up yet. William's leaving. I hate the Queen family being separated, but I appreciate that, unlike the way Robert disregarded Emiko, we see Oliver finally letting William have a voice in what happens to him. I'm glad Oliver reassured him that he'd always have a home and that they would keep in touch. My biggest frustration is that they didn't have to kill Samantha. She could have just been in a coma this whole time and then woken up and taken him. So true. I feel like if Beth was in control, that's exactly what would have happened, but Googie just likes to kill moms. Yes. Yes, he does. And then we'll talk about her correct predictions in our prediction section, because that's how we like to do.
Her correct predictions, yes.
All right. So Shai's got some flash thoughts for us. Hello, ladies. After watching the Flash episode last night, I was left with a few thoughts. The episode was okay for me. I will say that Grant being in the crossover and then getting married and going on his honeymoon has hurt the back half of the season so far. perfectly understandable reasons why his presence has been limited, but you can tell the difference because of how it changes the dynamic of the show. Whenever they make the side characters the center of the episode, and Barry and Iris are not as much of a presence, it doesn't work for me, whether it's Ralph, Killer Frost, or Nora taking over the mantle. The other issue is Joe West being gone, something that couldn't be helped due to his injury, but it makes things seem off-center and extremely noticeable at times. We've gotten some great West Allen moments this season, but then we've got episodes like this back half and a few others where they barely interact. I don't need a bunch of kissing scenes, like I've seen some fans cry for, but I would like to see them acting like more of a couple. Small touches, talking out all the craziness that's affecting their lives, instead of leaving it up to fans to assume that this is happening. It's great that Barry and Iris are being parents to Nora, but it's also important to see dialogue between him and Iris about all of this. I agree with all this. Anyway, I'm also left wondering, especially after Barry's talk with Nora at the end, when do they have the talk about Nora going back to the future? I'm guessing Barry wants to defeat Cicada before feeling okay with Nora going back, and I know that episode 15 is when all these issues I talked about should be resolved with Grant and JLM back, so I'm hoping that we can get the momentum that the season started with. Between the 100th episode and the crossover, I feel the season since then hasn't been consistent. I've enjoyed individual episodes, but the season as a whole has had issues. If the team stands around one more time while Cicada is down and doesn't put Metacup on him, I will lose my mind. If Barry and Iris don't get more screen time on a consistent basis, or don't get back to being Barry and Iris on screen for a more consistent basis, I will not be happy. And if we don't get more journalist Iris, I will be disappointed. If things don't start coming to a head with Nora and the symbols, I will be irritated. We've dragged out these storylines long enough, and it's time to start seeing the effects of all this. It's time for someone aside from Sherlock to start asking some questions. That's true, because Nora has, in fact, been acting shady as hell. It's time for West Allen to make the Tornado Twins. So what we need is our own little hint of Barry and Iris in bed, followed by Nora talking to some random character who doesn't have to be Don Allen. That's anyway. let's take a page out of their book, right? It's about time. We gotta return
the reverse copy.
Exactly. anyway, so overall, she still enjoys the show, but she's disappointed with the back half of this season. And we are right there with you. Those feelings are our feelings, I think, for the most part. Okay, next we've got Danielle's feedback. Shai had a question for us about Mary Sue's, which we will have an actual discussion about in this probably also Monster-like podcast. So, Danielle, Flash, the episode was fun, especially Nora and Cisco. I want more of that. Nora tried to fix the loop alone 52 times. I get why they chose it, but it's a trend. That the writers choose played out Easter eggs over actual character. Mm-hmm. I get her not wanting to disappoint Barry or not wanting to let anyone die, but it was ridiculous that it makes Nora seem foolish not to ask for help. At this point, she's learned this lesson and technically didn't even need to ask for help. The team figured it out. Okay. Carlos is great, but oh my God, with his gag over character shit. Cisco suddenly thinks he needs to be somebody else to date Camilla because of Ralph? No, thank you. Ignoring this could be his last season, it's maddening how aggressive they're being with Cisco. I mean, seeing different versions of him was fun, but oh my God, this, like, physically hurt me. I didn't even think season one Cisco was this level of insecure. It was always about his work. The one place he was secure in was himself. And he used to show up to work in graphic tees, for goodness sake. But the Nora Cisco stuff was a highlight for me. Also the 2 seconds of Iris and Cisco interaction, which I had to think back to and be like, wait a second, what was that? But yes, those 2 seconds were... Arrow. What happened to Dinah was not great. The flash forward stuff makes me even less interested in the present. Why am I watching if everything's going to turn out shitty? And even more besmirched versions of these characters exist. Especially because they already sort of made Thea Mia. Yes, they did make Thea Mia. By making her middle name Dearden. So I'm not sure why we had to get yet another bastardized version of her. Also, didn't the press releases all say Maya? I don't even want to get started on her, and Roy still sucks, sorry. Wow.
I know, like, what is Roy doing this season? We don't know.
He's like, hey, what's up? I'm still here, guys. I want to be excited about the Grace stuff, but is that even happening this season? I think Jeff's right about not being fit to be a head teacher, but that doesn't mean that Lowry is. That was a little disappointing. So true. And this is our resident Cisco fan, so don't forget, Danielle's our resident Cisco fan. Now, back to Shai, who had a, Mary Sue question for us. So, I was browsing on YouTube the other day, and a video came up on my timeline with a certain flash reviewer doing a rant after last week's episode about Iris being a Mary Sue. As I stated before I ventured to the fandom last year, believing that I'm interacting with fans like me, what greeted me was fans who enjoy the show and West Allen, but unfortunately, also a bunch of entitled fanboys who hate Iris and are assholes as well. For the sake of my sanity, I had to scale back from social media because it was just too toxic. So, curiosity got the best of me, and I clicked on this video to see what the fanboys were crying about now, and sure enough, they were all up in their feelings about the Iris and Cicada fight scene. Of course, they brought up Iris jumping off a roof to save Barry, and then the Iris bashing party began. Ranting about how Iris is a Mary Sue. Needless to say, I didn't watch the whole video due to being pissed. I don't know how Candace dealt with this crap for years and continues to deal with it with such grace and class. My respect for her, which was pretty high before, has now gone through the roof because this is so freaking stupid. It's season 5 and they're still hating. Have you heard this term used before to describe Iris, or is this something new? And how do you ladies handle this idiocy that continue to be a part of fandom?
Mary Sue is not new.
Yeah, no. Mary Sue is not new. Not for Iris and not in general, but... Yeah.
Well, what's interesting is that it started off as a term used in fan fiction long ago, and it was primarily for, like, self-insertion for an author or a character that was, like, the best of the best and who had everyone's eyes, could do no wrong, blah, blah, blah. But it was meant as, like, a parody of characters who were actually doing that. But it's kind of been... used now for general things, like, so fanboys equate it to, like, disliking a female character as automatically being a Mary Sue, which is incorrect. And it's also, like, a gender biased term because it's essentially there to hate on or, like, overly criticize female characters. But no, Iris is not a Mary Sue because she is not perfect. She fails sometimes. She's not always confident in herself. She has moments of, you know, human feelings, and this applies for, like, every woman across, like, the Arrowverse shows. So they have a right to feel what they feel and do what they do, and that doesn't necessarily make them this perfect being that can do no wrong and is never criticized, because that's not the case specifically for Iris, because she's, like, she's criticized in the narrative sometimes, and she's also criticized a lot by fan people, you know, fan people.
Right.
Fandom.
I feel like there's, like, because there are some fans that are not people.
That's true.
I think there's, like, two things that are going on. First of all, you have, like, well, specifically for Iris, first you have the fact people that don't like Iris, they don't like Iris, but Barry likes Iris, and Barry thinks that the world of Iris, and he loves her, and he thinks he's perfect, so therefore, the writers must be actually writing her as she's perfect, which is not the case, but I think that's one of the reasons why people kind of, oh, she must be a Mary Sue because Barry thinks she can do no wrong kind of thing, and then, like, the other part of that is that Iris fans, especially because Iris is played by a black woman, and we already know the deal as soon as, you know, there's a casting for a black woman in any kind of potentially romantic role with a white or a romantic partner of a different race, that she's going to be criticized. Or even if it's not even like a romantic thing, like, just black women in general are criticized. And so on the get-go, if someone is saying something about Iris, her fans are right there immediately. And so it becomes like, well, I'm not allowed to criticize Iris, therefore she must be, like, a Mary Sue. Like, anything that they can't, you know, I can't hate on this character openly like I want to, so she must be a Mary Sue. And that's kind of, like, the catch-all term they use, that, you know, they can just throw that out there, and it... because of the connotations that the term Mary Sue has, they don't even have to, like, defend it or whatever. Since they can't say what they really want to say, they'll just throw that label on it, and then that will be the label that sticks, and there's nothing anybody else can do about it because of the connotations that that term has, which is also, like, incorrect. And if you look at, like, across the Arrowverse, and you look at, like, the definition of a Mary Sue, and, you know, kind of this kind of, she's used like a prodigy character, she can do all these things, she doesn't have any faults, everything always comes to her. Like, that's, I could name, like, a list of characters on the Arrowverse shows. Like, if, on The Flash, you have Caitlin, who is, like, a prodigy, has two or three different degrees. She's a biochemist, but she's also, like, a medical doctor and an OBGYN, and anything, like, that the plot needs, she can do it. And then, like, she, you know, there's a lot of issues that people in fandom have that she doesn't really seem to be held accountable for a lot of things. She just kind of, so that like, that would be, you know, the typical, like, the wish fulfillment kind of thing. But then again, like, Caitlin also has, like, her flaws and things like that. If you look at Arrow with Felicity Smoke, with one, you know, well-timed keyboard smash, she can topple government security systems and do, like, everything that comes, like, easy to her. But she also has her flaws. You've got Lena Luthor on Supergirl, another one that's super young, owns Fortune 500 companies, can, you know, push a button and automatically fly spaceship technology from, like, the 31st century. Those are also, quote-unquote, Mary Sue-type qualities. But, you know, again, like, she also has her insecurities. So there's this whole thing about, you know, women in the Arrowverse, if they're allowed to do, they could have those kind of, like, stereotypical Mary Sue type qualities that they can do all these kind of things. But then again, like, that's only, like, if you're only focusing on that, that's very surface level interpretation of that's all that this woman can do. When you actually, like, look at, you know, her entire character and look at her more than just, like, the surface person, you see all these, like, little flaws, and, like, just let women be, like, more 3D kind of people instead of this label, and then that's the end of the discussion. That's all that she is this label, because I don't like her and I can't defend it, so I'm just gonna stick this label on her.
Yeah, and the funny part is that if she does showcase any flaws or anything like that, she's criticized for it. So it's like, what do you want?
You didn't want her to be perfect, and now she's not, and you're still not happy, so.
Exactly, yeah, no, exactly, like, and then just the fact that the term is Mary Sue and that it was first created to be directed at women is just more another example of just, like, the misogyny, you know, internalized or otherwise, that is in present in fandom all the time, right? Because, like, yeah, there's, like, the Gary Stu version, but, like, that's, like, you don't really use that. You really only use Mary Sue whenever you see any woman who does anything that you're, like, jealous of. Like when Rey was a Mary Sue because she was able to fly the Millennium Falcon, even though it's no different from Han Solo being able to do it, but whatever. So for me, it's just something that I would say men use, but obviously women use it too. It's just something that you use to attack female characters and to attack female fans too, because it's like, oh, this character is aspirational and therefore bad, right? Like, even the fact that they say, like, oh, it's a self-insert character, like, oh, you just want to see yourself in this story, and that's bad. So, yeah, that's why I don't like the term Mary Sue, and I don't use it, and I think that, yeah, it's fake news. So, but yeah, Iris is certainly not one, because of everything you guys have already said. The fact that they had to go above and beyond to make her, quote-unquote, perfect, to, like, make sure that she couldn't be attacked for certain things in the early seasons, is not because she's a quote-unquote Mary Sue, but because fandom is the way that it is, right? Because people are racist and sexist and will take any opportunity to attack her. And then in the later seasons, when they were already comfortable with her position and then let her be, you know, more human, let her make more mistakes, then people, again, immediately attack her for those mistakes. And then get upset when the narrative does not punish her the way that they want her to be punished. Because it's not like it doesn't punish her. Like, this entire episode was a consequence of Iris' action in the previous episode, right?
Right.
If she had not tracked down Takeda and stabbed him, then he would not know that she's working with the Flash, and then somehow also know that Ralph is the Elongated Man, etc. and then try 53 times to kill them. So her actions do have consequences. Success! She's not a Mary Sue. Anyway. And again, like I've already said before, like, we've seen moments where she's wrong and where she acknowledges that too. So it's like, there's no reason to not think of her as a three-dimensional character and to know that sometimes she's right, sometimes she's not right. Like, right. Sometimes in her interactions with Nora, she's not right. And sometimes, like in season 4, when she didn't believe that Mary could come back. And Sisko was the one that believed and brought him back. And then she was like, oh, thank you, Sisko, for believing when I couldn't believe. Because she's acknowledging that there's another perspective that was more correct than her perspective and let it work out directly by not doing what she said to do. And that's how it worked out. So it's all fine. Okay. Now we shall move on to our actual discussion. There was a Supergirl, but we will discuss the series premiere of Doom Patrol, along with Arrow on side A, and then Flash and Black Lightning on side B. So May, we'll take it away with our first impressions of Doom Patrol. And then, at the end of our discussions, as always, we will nominate our latest assumption of the week.
Yay, I'm May. And side A is called Super Zero / Don't Sweat the Haters, and Doom Patrol is our new favorite show. So I'm going to read you the summary from what WB has provided me because I was too lazy to write up my own. Basically, Doom Patrol reimagines one of DC's most beloved groups of superheroes, Robot Man, Elastawoman, Crazy Jane, and Larry Trainer, a.k.a. Negative Man, led by modern-day mad scientist Niles Calder, a.k.a. the Chief. So each member of the Doom Patrol suffered a horrible accident that gave them superhuman abilities, but also left them scarred and disfigured. So traumatized and downtrodden, the team found their purpose through the Chief, coming together to investigate the weirdest phenomena in existence. Following the mysterious disappearance of the Chief, these reluctant heroes will find themselves in a place they never expected to be, called by action, by none other than Cyborg, who comes to them with a mission hard to refuse. Part supergroup, part superhero team, the Doom Patrol is a band of superpowered freaks. Part support group, part superhero team, the Doom Patrol is a band of superheroed freaks who fight for a world who wants nothing to do with them. I know we watched the first two episodes, but we're going to focus more on the first episode. What did we, kind of like, what were our first impressions? What did we think overall about the story and characters?
Well, I absolutely loved it. We stand a self-aware show that managed to poke fun at itself while still delivering high-quality writing and acting and a strong message. Because a lot of times you will see shows where they'll be like, LOL, let's go into the hallway for our hallway discussion. And you're like, that's funny, but stop with the hallway discussions. And they don't, because they don't actually want to change anything. They just want to be like, we're self-aware. But Doom Patrol is like, we're self-aware, but also we're not even bad in the first place. So you're not really making fun of us. We're making fun of ourselves. And you don't even have a reason to. You're like, stop saying that. You're perfect. Don't say that, Doom Patrol. Anyway, so I've heard people talking about how Doom Patrol is like the superior X-Men, or is like the answer to X-Men, or like people be like, Doom Patrol came first, actually. And I was like, there's no correlation between Doom Patrol and X-Men. I don't understand what y'all are talking about. But then I watched this show and I was like, okay, I see now what is happening. I see the correlation between Doom Patrol and X-Men. Just like, I love this the way that they have shown this group of people, like, you know, it's like something's happened to them, like they're now different from the rest of society. But they still are human beings who want to be loved, who want to be accepted, who want to be of use to a society that is not going to accept them. And for once, it's not like we just have all these superhuman powers and like we're just like, quote unquote, better than people and therefore present like a danger to people, because it's not really that case. It's more that they're so different and that in some cases their powers may seem useless, right? Like, what is the point of being negative? Yeah, what is the point of love moment? You know, like, it's just like, this is a horrible, like, what is this? So they don't know how they fit in, right? There is no way that they can immediately see to be of use to society or to make themselves accepted by the society. So they've created their own little society together. And I love that. I also, at first, I was thrown off by the casting change for Chief, especially because, like, Bruno Bashir is, like, a Mexican actor, and then James Bond obviously is not. So I was like, what has happened? But they also, like, rewrote his character, so, like, now I'm fine with it. Because in the Titans episode, he seemed, like, super overbearing and sinister, like, to the point that I was like, he's clearly a bad guy. Please leave this place. Like, why would anyone stay with him? Like, does he have them trapped? Are there, like, invisible chains? That doesn't make sense. But here, in Doom Patrol, he really does feel, like, a dad to them. He really feels like someone who's taking them in, who's taking care of them. He seems, like, really, like, you know, like, soft and, like, he's providing outcasts with a safe haven.
Right.
So it's easy to believe that they would have stayed here and not ventured out for decades in some cases. Which does leave me with a couple of questions. Like, I'm like, are they, what's the common denominator? Like, what made them immortal? Or, like, why don't they age? But for the most part, I'm so swept up in the storyline, in the character work, that I'm very happy to wait for answers. Or even if they never tell me, I probably won't care that much. So, because as long as the show stays as good as the first two episodes. Also, I love, love, love Alan Tudyk as the narrator. He set the show apart from, like, the very first scene. Because first, his tone and his, you know, jokes, the way that he tells the, like, that gives the dark comedy, keeps the tone from feeling too depressing, right? Because, like, even when horrible things are happening on screen, you're still laughing because of something that he just said. And also, his unreliability as a narrator adds that layer of, like, not knowing who to trust and not knowing what's really real or not, which is reflected in certain backstories, like Cliff's backstory, which was sort of the way we were introduced to the Doom Patrol. Because, like, Ron, obviously, we had Mr. Nobody, but then he's the first introduction to Doom Patrol, and it's like, so what really happened to him? You know, and then it's like, so who's really dead? So, yeah, I look forward to seeing more of that as the show progresses. Speaking of the characters, I love all of them, like, from the get-go, especially the, you know, the misfits, the island misfit toys. I love how they wove in everyone's backstory. They included pathos for them. They made sure to give them equal time to shine. Titans cannot relate. The only Doom Patrol, the only Doom Patroller whose past is still a blank slate is Crazy Jane's, and that's on purpose, right? We have to wait to find out what happened to Jane to make her this way. And by the way, Diane Guerrero is killing it. I did not, like, I love her already. I think she's super talented and awesome, but I did not, even I did not know that she could pull off 64 personalities. So, you go, Diane. I can't wait. I can't wait to see more. Also, I love that Cliff saw her as a kindred spirit from the start, despite how ugly their first interaction was, that he still reached out to her and he wanted to get to know her and help her. And I'm very much rooting for that friendship.
Yay! Yay. Like, I was so off the bat with the first episode, I was just like, this shit is bananas. B-A-N-A-N-A-S. And it really is. It's so, like, I'm so impressed by this show. Like, you can definitely tell, like, Doom Patrol is the favorite child in the DC universe. And, like, because we're talking about, just from the castings, like, you know, Titans must have been, like, pushed to the back when they decided to go with, like, Doom Patrol, because all the money is going to the show. And you can tell. The writing and the acting is just, like, top quality and top notch. Alan Tudyk as Mr., like, Nobody, and his, like, sarcastic commentary, it was, like, hilarious. And to have him as, like, the narrator, kind of, you know, poking jabs at everybody the whole way through the premiere, it just makes it, like, the ridiculousness of the situation even more so, and just, like, really funny. And I like that we got introduced to each of the characters' backstories through his shady narration, because that just makes it even more, you know, you get, like, part of the story of these characters' backstories, but then you also have this shady narrator kind of throwing in his, like, color commentary on it. So you do kind of wonder, like, how much is real and how much isn't, and, you know, it adds a lot of color to the show. But we don't really know, like, from the beginning of the episode, we know something happened to him, but I don't even think you know that it's him necessarily. I think he tells you, but you don't really know from the first scene how he fits in to the show,
right,
into the Doom Patrol until, like, later on in the episode. And then each character of the Doom Patrol in the first episode gets, like, sufficiently fleshed out backstory introduction. So, like, you start with Cliff Steele, aka Robot Man, and I like that we were introduced through Cliff, because he is just being introduced to the Doom Patrol and to the dog and all the other members of the house. So, like, we're sharing our first experience with the Doom Patrol with Cliff. So I thought that was really well done. And it feels like, in general, all the characters are introduced in these, like, the acts over the course of the first episode. So the first act is Cliff. And then he, like, through his story, it brings us up through into the present. And then we get another closer look at, we get, like, glimpses of Rita and her personality and Negative Man and his personality. And then once you reach the present, you start to get into these people that we've been watching with Cliff over the past, like, decade or however long he's been there. And each character has their own kind of, they're not, they're already 3D. And, like, for example, with Rita, there's aspects to Rita that it's just, like, really, I don't know, like, why she's, like, she's kind of, like, stuck up and very stuck on herself, but then you see that in her backstory, but then there's also another side to her, like, she's very much, like, the reluctant, negative Debbie Downer within the group, even though Negative Man has his own, like, negative tweaks to why he doesn't want to, like, venture out. But they all feel very, like, real. And then Crazy Jean comes in, like, the last act and, like, the climax. And, like, Diane Guerrero has the range. Like, if you ever wondered if she could pull this off, like, she definitely has the range for this character. And it's, like, it's really kind of amazing. But I think we talked about, like, Tatiana Mansley last week with...
Oh, yeah.
The way that she plays, like... 8 different characters in one episode. Mm-hmm. And, like, Diane is basically doing that because Crazy Jane is, like, split into 64 different personalities. And so each time... And the personalities, like, change like that. So, like, just in, like, a snap, like, she has to go from, you know, the Hangman's daughter to, like, Baby Doll or something like that. And it's just, like, this really... And each character, each personality has, like, a different backstory, a different superpower. So, like, watching her go through all of these in, like, seconds is really cool to see. The show in general kicks off with like almost an apocalyptic type event with an entire town being involved in the first episode. And it's insane and it's over the top and everything works. And it's like, you know, when Titans came out, they're like, oh, this is the best TV show ever, DC TV series. But, you know, unlike, you know, people trying to like collectively blow smoke up Titans' ass and say that it's like the best thing since sliced bread, like, Doom Patrol actually deserves the hype of being the best.
And I love how we're saying that after 2 episodes, but yeah.
Poor Titans is now, like, the neglected child.
I feel like a lot of TV shows, when they have, like, the first episode is usually kind of, like, meh, because you have to do, like, all of, like, the narration and like, the background stuff, and then maybe it gets good. But this one starts, like, really strong, like, out the gate. So it's just like, wow, where are we going from here? It is a crazy ride, y'all.
I mean, they have a donkey that's just, like... I don't even know how to explain it. You just, like, have to watch it. It's just... It's wild. And I think one of my favorite things is the fact that they do give equal time to, like, all the characters. At first, when I saw the opening, I was worried it was just going to be, like, about Cliff. And I was like, oh, Cliff's backstory is going to be the whole hour or whatever. But it's about everyone. And it's great. And it's amazing. And I really love that the show is willing to take so many crazy risks because it does pay off. Like, the writing is really sharp. The show is really funny, which I didn't expect it to be. And then the showrunner, Jeremy Carver... is really good. He wrote some of my favorite Supernatural episodes, and he does, like, he has an eye for the outlandish and zany, so the premise really works because of that. So if, like, you want to see a great Groundhog Day episode, you go back and watch Mystery Spot from, like, season 3 of Supernatural, because he does crazy stuff. And now he gets to finally, like, really get away with it. And I even love how the narration breaks the fourth wall at times and, like, mocks fans and other DC properties. And then, like you guys already said, Diane Guerrero is a standout, and I'm really invested in her friendship with Robot Man right now, specifically. Like, you can really tell that DC Universe provided the budget for the show, because it's better lit, for one, than Titans ever was. I think it has the potential to be really special and different, and with the strong storytelling and cast, I think I'm willing to, like, let it take me wherever it wants to go, because I'm just gonna be along for the ride. But what are we looking forward to coming up for the season, based on, like, what we've seen or what we want to see?
Well, not to spoil anything, but I am looking forward to Cyborg being, like, the de facto leader of the Doom Patrol, and to his existence at all, because he appears in the second episode, and he's great, at least in that episode, so we'll see. Also, more of Robot Man and Jane's friendship, as pointed out, is one of the highlights, and more of Alan Tudyk's hilarious narration. Overall, though, I'm super excited to delve into Jane's backstory, what made her the way she is, what happened to her, and then, of course, like, Mr. Nobody and, like, why he's so freaking mad. So I also hope that we get to see each of the characters, like, reconnect with whatever's left of their previous lives, or, like in Cliff's case, like, really learn what happened, and then, like, maybe in, I was about to call her, in Rita's case, like, sort of, like, get some closure for her time, you know, her Hollywood time, or, like, have some kind of run-in with, like, New Hollywood and be like, oh, no, I don't want this, et cetera. And also, you know, getting to explore more now that Chief is potentially out of the picture for now.
Yeah, and I hope we, like, we do get introduced to Cyborg in episode 2, and so we'll be able to discuss more about his introduction next week. But I do echo Tati, and, like, I like that he, how he's introduced. And I don't think it's really much of a spoiler, because it's included in, like, the what's the show about, that he comes in with this mission, and they kind of rally around that. But I do like that he basically becomes, like, de facto leader of the team, and he's really, like, present from the moment that he's introduced. So I'm really looking forward to more of Crazy Jane in general and her 64 personalities, because she's killing it. Like, Diane is killing it, first of all. And I want to see, and I guess we'll talk about it next week, but they kind of give you, like, a brief general kind of thing about how these 64 personalities coexist together. So I'm looking forward, as the season goes on, into getting into the underground and what that actually means and how it works. I think Alan Tudyk is, like, the best big bad that is out here right now. And the fact that he seems to be, like, omniscient and knows everything about everyone, and he has this way of, like, manipulating that so that you don't know what's real and what's not real, I think is going to make him very fun over the course of the season. And the show, like I said, like, the show is already insane in 2 episodes. It's already, like, so out there that I don't even know, like, how to predict. It's like on a roller coaster, and you don't really know, like, when the next, like, drop is coming, or the next loop or whatever. So it's really, I'm just along for the ride, y'all, to be honest.
Yeah, same. I'm definitely, yeah. I definitely agree about Cyborg. Totally agree. I'm looking forward to Cyborg coming in and us discussing him later. And then I'm looking forward to getting more backstory on Crazy Jane as well, specifically seeing exactly where the plot will go with her, or rather her backstory, and where the plot will tie into that, and how Chief is involved in everything, because I think that's really fascinating. And then I echo, Alan Tudyk is fantastic, so I definitely look forward to the day when he finally gets to interact with the rest of the cast and see how that goes. All right, do we have any predictions for the show?
I just said there's no way to predict it on the show.
Yeah, no, no, I think looking forward to is, like, our predictions, because we expect that to happen.
Yeah.
All right, we'll keep you updated.
All right.
Moving on to Arrow. To recap, the episode was called Star City Slayer. Oliver and Felicity are disappointed after they learn that William is hiding something from them. Wanting to focus on his family, Oliver steps back from his Green Arrow duties and lets the team take over tracking down a serial killer. However, when the team becomes targets for the killer, things take a bloody turn. Gregory Smith directed the episode, written by Beth Schwartz and Jill Blankenship. What did we like?
Okay, I loved the ominous music at the beginning when they were, like, reading the stalkery notes. It made for a great opener, and it really gave you that vibe of it being a thriller, right? And, of course, was a great lead-in for Stan to be a much more intimidating villain than DS. I loved the actor's performance. He was incredibly creepy. I read a review saying that he was too hammy of a performance, like, it was too much, it was, like, too obvious that he was off-kilter, but I disagree, because obviously at that point he was, you know, full-blown in the middle of stalking and trying to murder.
Like, the jail, like, he was already, like, crazy, so this is not, but, like, the information.
It was, like, a contained performance in the jail, so, like, I see why, like, it's, like, a difference, but that's because he was, at that point, like, honing in on his next victim, right? He was, like, looking for someone. He found Oliver. Once he was fixated on Oliver, things escalate from there, and now it's like, I must have Oliver for myself, so whatever, I liked it. Also, I loved when Curtis shouted out, "I know you did last summer," because I remember those days. But yeah, the whole thing, like, the whole, like, powder thing, like, when they were, like, couldn't move anymore, I was like, oh, I'm afraid. And then I even felt kind of bad when he was talking about his dad, and I sort of see the parallel, but, like, not, because it was, like, kind of weird, like, oh, bad dad's parallel. Just like, oh, you're not that bad, Oliver, it's fine.
I was kind of wondering if that was supposed to be something. I was like,
yeah, exactly, like, wait a second. I mean, Oliver's kids both turn out a little bit, you know. Mia more so. Mia more so than William, but something could have went wrong there. Anyway, as has been a running theme, I did appreciate Oliver once again keeping cool under pressure, displaying his maturity in the face of a like whacked out villain, even if he wasn't as mature in the face of his son. Speaking of his son, I did like seeing William stand up to Oliver. Their yelling match like made me feel bad, but it felt like realistic. Like this is the conversation I wanted to see them have last week. That I was like waiting. I was like, why did we put this off? But now it's like William explodes. We get to hear what he really feels about how his dad has behaved in terms of parenthood for the last year. So it was good. I'd probably want to live elsewhere if I was William too. And I understood Felicity's point of view too, like when she was saying like, oh, we've got to give William the life that he deserves. But we'll talk in the slides about like, I don't understand what happens after that. Because they were like, we're going to call you all the time and we'll visit you and whatever. And I was like, that's great. I love this.
Live.
And also, like, he lives in Central City, right? That's where his grandparents live. So it's like, that's so nice that he can just pop on up whenever he goes to the Flash to visit his son. Anyway, I greatly enjoyed Dinah and Zoe's interactions in the present and in the future. I love seeing, like, their training sessions and then, like, you know, paralleling that to how close they are in the Flash forwards. And also, I like seeing Renee and Dinah's friendship on display once more, even if I'm impatiently waiting to see them patch things up in the future when he reveals why he's being so weird. While Kirk's exit was upsetting, I am glad to see that he's getting his own little version of a happy ending, right? Like, he's gonna follow his own moral compass. He's gonna do whatever humanitarian deeds he can do with his genius. And I hope that it does serve as a wake-up call to Dickle. Like, I liked seeing Diggle and Lila try to keep him around, even if it was off screen, right? Like, we heard that they were trying to keep him around. I thought that was nice. And it's, like, nice showing that someone somewhere cares about Curtis. Also, enjoyed his sweet goodbye to Felicity. I thought it was really sweet that the show finally remembered that they were friends right before he goes off forever. But, you know, him giving her Helix, I guess, was a nice gesture, even though we'll talk about that later. Mm. Okay. Then the cameo from Captain Singh was, like, the last thing, but, like, the best thing. I really loved it. I liked him, like, saying something about metahumans, and then being like, oh, I'm sorry, Dinah. I don't mean you, of course. I mean other metahumans. And then when he gave her the pep talk, it was really sweet. So, yeah, I really liked that. Like, it was a nice way of establishing the larger world in a very, like, small amount of time. Like, their dynamic was believable, even though we've never, you know, really seen it interact. So, finally, I liked the Mia Smoke reveal in terms of, like, the music was badass. Like, Fat played it in a really cocky way, like, a fun cocky way. So, yeah, like, I think it was, like, well done. Even if the reveal itself is whatever it is.
You know what I thought? When you were talking about Curtis, one of the things that I remembered in the episode that was really subtle, like, he's still, like, him and that police officer are still going out, right? And, like, it seemed like Curtis didn't even, like, he barely registered that the dude was in the picture, because, like, that police officer that gave them, like, the information or whatever, like, he came over to the group and he, like, looked at Curtis, and Curtis, like, barely interacted.
I thought they broke up, though. Or did they? Am I just assuming that they did, because we never see
him? No, I don't think they broke up. I think that we thought they were going to break up, and then it turned out that
Curtis was a vigilante, and then they were, like, you know. It doesn't matter if you're originally into
remember, you. We heard that there was that character that was supposed to come in that was, like, a businessman or something who was, like, interested in Curtis. And that never happened. And we were confused because we were like, but what about his boyfriend? Like, did they break up? Because they hadn't broken up yet. And then we never saw hide or hair of anything related to that.
Interesting. So, yeah.
But anyway, that's kind of weird. Maybe that's another topic for another section or, like, another day or whatever. But this episode, it was really intense, and it was a really good episode, and mostly the parts that I like were mostly stuff that was happening in the present. Like, Stan the Fan was just, like, creepy as shit. I think, like, the use of all of the horror tropes and worked really well with him as the villain of the week. It felt like a really intense episode of Pretty Little Liars. Because, like, people were, like, dying, and you didn't know, like, who the the killer was, and all, like, the main characters are, you know, just, like, freaking out and, like, suspicious and paranoid and stuff. So it's like, oh, Pretty Little Liars. The actor that plays him, I guess, Brendan Fletcher, is his name. I thought that he did an excellent job at being Stan and being this obsessed creepy stalker. I didn't think his performance was ham at all. I thought, because, like, in like, horror movies, like, the scene with, like, the Queen family is, like, the climax of the horror movie where you really see the person's, like, the villain's craziness and all of its, like, splendor or whatever. So, I, like, as the climax of the episode, I thought that it was really well done. And that was probably, like, my favorite scene was in, like, the one in the Queen apartment when they suddenly realize that they can't move and he comes in and he, like, really, really goes off the deep end. And we learn, like, why Stan is the way he is. Like, his whole backstory about, like, the abuse he received at the hands of his father, using, like, that medicine to immobilize and correct him, made me feel, like, really, it was, like, really tragic, creepy kind of backstory. And, like, how his brother was, like, always protecting him, but, like, because of all the abuse that Stan endure that kind of, like, turned him into something crazy and, like, killing his parents and then, like, idolizing these older brother figures, and that's kind of how he chooses, like, as a serial killer, as how he chooses, like, his fixations. And so, like, all of that is really kind of interesting, and I kind of wish we had more of that as, like, an arc or whatever, rather than Diaz, but... I think it just, like, think him as a, they did a really good job at like, really fleshing out his entire story within the episode that they had. And I, honestly, like, poor William, because Stan's, like, crazy freak out came at literally the worst time for Oliver and Felicity to convince William that he could have a normal life with them. Like, I do not blame that kid for wanting to get the fuck out of Star City. I mean, like, that's exactly why. Exhibit A! Well, I do not want to live with you guys. And I'm glad that the writers gave him that space for his feelings to be mad and to actually have it out with Oliver, because, you know, we also talked about last week about why is Felicity getting all the brunt of these feelings when, you know, it's still Oliver's son and there should have been some kind of time, especially with them doing, like, the documentary. But I'm glad that we got it in this episode. And especially, like, that one of William's points is that Oliver goes off and does these things on his own without asking other people's opinions, especially the people that are most affected by those decisions that he makes. And we talked a lot last season, and earlier this season, about Felicity having the right to be upset for Oliver going off to jail without consulting her. But William definitely does, too, because, you know, that's his dad, and he wasn't part of William's life for a long time, not Oliver's not Oliver's fault, but now that he is, and he's just unilaterally decided to dip from William's life again, William had a right to be mad about that. There's some things about the confrontation that I did not like, but that is for another section, so.
Yeah, I echo the horror movie-esque and how it made the whole episode feel. And going into the abandoned house, seeing Stan's own stalker wall, the music and the scares were done really well. And I'm glad we finally got to see William being mad at Oliver too. Because last week, Felicity got the brunt of the anger, like you guys said. And now Oliver had to face his son's wrath. So at this, and his points were all valid. And I like that he brought it back to the decision Oliver made to go to prison. And after all the stuff with Stan, his decision made sense. I also like that we got to see Oliver's frustration and that he ultimately gave William a choice of whether or not he wanted to stay, even if that choice hurt him. And I love the parallel of Zoe and Dinah in the future to showing Dinah training Zoe in the present, because I just love their relationship. And I was also really happy to see Renee and Dinah back on solid ground with each other in the future. Or no, in the present. See, the flash forwards are confusing me. And the actor who played Stan was really, really good. I was terrified of him and what he was capable of, but at the same time, I felt really bad for him after he revealed his backstory. And then in just one episode, he proved to be more of a threat than Diaz, just like Shang was talking about. Like, the reasons behind why he was so fixated on Oliver specifically made way more sense in this episode. And then finally, I'm so happy that Curtis didn't die and that he got to go out on his own terms while staying true to what he believed in. Like, he realized he wasn't cut out to work for Argus and probably realized Helix wasn't going anywhere. So he bailed, and good for him, because, you know, just like William, he's like, I'm about to about to leave the city. I can't even get a stalker card.
Yeah. I did forget to mention, like, in my, like, I forgot to write it down, but I also like the little training montage with Zoe and Dinah. And I agree with Tasha, because, like, it did remind me as well of how in the comics and in, like, the DCAU, whenever you see Black Canary, she is kind of like this teacher, this, like, den mom kind of figure, and helping out, like, the, like, Young Justice or a lot of the other, like, younger superheroes. So it was nice to see that aspect of Dinah and Zoe in the episode.
Yeah. Oh, and I forgot to mention, too, that Singh cameo, because I just, like, love when he appeared on screen. That's my man, so I was really happy. Moving on to our dislikes, what didn't we like about this episode of Arrow?
What didn't we like? Okay, so William's a tech genius, but he can't solve a Rubik's Cube. This thing's very dumb. I don't know. I don't understand William or his talents. Also, I didn't like that he called his grandparents without telling Oliver in the first place. Like, they just kind of dropped in the episode out of nowhere. Like, obviously, everyone has grandparents, whether they're alive or not, or, like, whether they know them or not. But, like, as far as I know, there was no previous reveal or even indication of Samantha's status with her parents. Like, right. Does she live with them? How much contact do they have with William? Whatever. Like, they just dropped in, like a deus ex machina, to rid Oliver of his son to make room for his daughter. And it reminds me of Dexter after they killed off Rita, thanks a lot, assholes, and he was left taking care of her two kids, which he had spent like three seasons, or actually four seasons at that point, developing his relationship with, and then their newborn baby, right? And they were like, this is too much. What are we going to do? So suddenly, the grandparents drop in and like, we're going to take these kids, bye. And I was like, what? What is happening? So that's how I felt, and I don't like that. Because I'm like, why did you invest in this dynamic just to take it away? And like, we knew they were going to be separated, but this is like the lamest way to separate them. Like, oh, the grandparents came and took them away, and then for some reason, I just forgot to contact him for a while. So now he feels abandoned, I guess. I don't know. I guess we'll see. Anyway, as scary as Dan himself was, I thought that, like, the part where they were actually, like, investigating his identity and trying to find out what happened was, like, a little bit boring and a lot dark, like, literal darkness when they're walking through his apartment looking for the pictures and just like, there's darkness, and then there is a flashlight. And I was like, can't you just turn on a light? Like, if he's not there, just turn on the light so that we can all see together, please. Anyway, I also obviously hated Dinah losing her canary cry that way, and this is the throat slash. I agree with Tasha that it took away, like, I wasn't concerned she was going to die, but I was very mad that she was just losing her cry right after being added as the Black Canary. Like, there was no rest time. There was no time for her to, like, be the Black Canary while people knew she was the Black Canary. It was like, oh, you're the Black Canary. Not anymore. Goodbye. Also, in the flash forwards, like, Mia's treatment of Zoe was, like, so weird and unnecessary. Like, I was like, why is Zoe specifically getting the brunt of this behavior? And also just, like, how do people not know about Felicity's daughter? Like, how is Mia, like, just this, like, black star person that, like, they don't know about? Did Felicity not tell Mia about William? Why was she surprised that that was her brother? Like, she'd never seen a picture of him? Like, she'd never even considered contacting him? I don't know. It was very weird. Like, 'cause she just seemed, like, in general, to be like, wait a second, Oliver is your father? Like, his sperm reached other ends? I know that the secrecy is being done to maintain the mystery, but, like, it obscures my understanding of what is happening in this moment. And so finally, this is, like, a small point, but I think it's weird and dumb and, like, Cisco-like that Laurel was the one that started off the stalker storyline last week. And then this week, they're like, well, it's fine. She's safe off-screen in D.C. or wherever she is. We'll see her next week when this is over. And I was like, oh, okay. Anyway, that's all.
That's a good point. Yeah. Because, like, he started with Laurel, that of the group that we know, and then just didn't go back around to her. I don't know.
And like,
they saw, he saw what happened to that one guy that looked at her wrong. And he's like, well,
he forgot about her like he forgot about Curtis.
Do what now?
I said he forgot about her like he forgot about Curtis.
No, Laurel got
at least Laurel got a soccer card. Like, as comically hilarious as I find it that Stan didn't even consider Curtis important enough to send a soccery letter. For real, like, that was just so funny to me. Like, when we went through, like, the opening intro of, like, Dinah and Diggle and Renee all getting, like, their soccer cards, and then it was like, and then the intro. And Curtis didn't even show up. But it's like, and then for this to be the episode that he actually leaves in, for it to be his send-off, is a little bit lacking in emotional depth. Like, I shouldn't find it, like, funny that he's not getting stalked by, like, a crazy killer, and then he actually, like, leaves. I feel like the whole build-up to his departure just seemed like one long series of, like, unfortunate, forgotten events. And it's like he obviously never comes back full-time because he's not included in the little, like, special tattoo club that all of the others and Oliver got to band them together. Like, he's not included in that. He fake dies pretty brutally when he's killed by Diaz in that little fever dream world. And now, in this episode, Stan will go out of his way. Like, Stan stalked and killed Diaz's associates because they were too close to Oliver. Like, that, like, the what is it, like, the whatever degrees from Kevin Bacon? It's like the whatever degrees from Oliver Queen.
Six degrees.
6 degrees Oliver Queen. He's killing, like, associates of Diaz just because, like, Diaz is connected to Oliver. But Curtis was literally on Oliver's team, worked with him for years, like, at least 2 years, and he can't so much as get, like, a read receipt on a text message from Stan. So, like, I don't understand, like, what does that say about how the show views Curtis as a character and a member of Team Arrow, you know? And then over in the Queen household, if I was going to be, like, nitpicky, I thought Steven went, like, 0 to 100 with his, like, acting choices of being, like, pancake dad, I don't care that you get expelled, to now listen here, young man, dad, and, like, his, like, angry side or whatever. But I'm not going to, like, focus on that. But I am going to take issue with how this got, like, so ugly so fast. The situation to the point that William called his grandparents behind his parents' backs and basically, like, emancipated himself from them. I can't really imagine how done he'd have to be to basically, like, quit his parents. And I feel like, I don't know if it has to do with, like, Steve, because Steven, the head of the book, is very, like, strained, angry, yelling. Why are you yelling at William? It's not William's fault that you left and that this, your situation is crazy. And, you know, like, he's getting very, like, no one's taking away my son from me, but you had no problem leaving his life. And I don't know. I just didn't really, I thought it was earned for William, but there's still parts of it that I thought was really, it kind of showed, like, the deterioration of their relationship to the point that William didn't feel safe to actually, like, bring up wanting to live with his grandparents or something like that, and having to do that behind his back. And then you skip forward to the future, and you see how shut off and angry and aggressive that Mia is, and the fact that neither sibling recognizes or knows anything about the other. And it, like Todd said, they're doing it for, like, mysteriously, like, drama.tm or whatever. But it is kind of, you know, like, how fucked up is this future kind of thing. And then you have Connor. Like, Connor, I couldn't tell if he was the same guy, same actor from The Legend. I think he is. So he's Diggle's son, and Dinah said that he's Diggle's son. But, so again, like, I don't really understand, because Diggle should be, JJ should be at least, like, a decade older than Mia, unless they had, Thyla had, like, another son, I don't know, somewhere in the future, and actually named him Connor, because then again, like, how is JJ now Connor? So I don't really think that they did a lot to explain that very well, and then how JJ knows Mia, but no one else knows Mia. How come William didn't recognize JJ? Like, there's a lot of, like, questions that aren't very well tied together for me yet.
Well, I'm glad that Curtis didn't die. I agree his exit lacked any buildup and just happened in one episode, so they had the chance to really make it more of a gut punch, but I think his exit showed how much the writers were never really invested in him. And, like, even Stan dismissed him, like we've been talking about. And then Mia smacking Zoe around bothered me a lot. Like, I also didn't care much for the reveal that she was Felicity and Oliver's daughter, mostly because the lead-up to it and the backstory makes no sense. Like you guys already mentioned, if Felicity is pregnant now, then did she just not tell anyone that she had a kid? Did she hide her this whole time and alienate herself from the team? Like, how could no one know that she existed? And most importantly, how could William not know that she existed? Speaking of William, his grandparents showing up surprised me, mostly because they'd never even been mentioned before. And I also thought it was a bizarre move to have him leave just as they introduced Mia as their daughter, because I thought that was a little bit, like, disrespectful to William. Like, we don't need this kid. We'll just have another one come in. And then suggesting that Oliver and Felicity never contacted him again just made them look like bad parents. And it was all just to keep the mystery alive. So I definitely didn't like the plot so heavily overshadowed consistent character stuff. Especially after Oliver got angry at Robert for never telling him about Emiko, they go and make Felicity do the same thing, essentially.
That is weird. Yeah.
Yeah. And then finally, I really disliked the throat slashing for Dinah. We already knew that Dinah would lose her canary cry, but the way that it was done was really vicious and too early for my liking. Because I just thought that it would happen down further down the line. Like, they may as well have not outed her as Black Canary, because now she no longer has that, and I think that's really sad. And I also think the story of Stan stalking them could have gone on for a couple of episodes, like Jessica said, before coming to a conclusion. Because his, like, plot line so far, I think, has made the most sense this season. So it was a shame it ended so early. But what do we predict moving forward?
I didn't talk about this in my dislikes because I was super, like, but it, okay, because it's not actually anything to do with, like, the episode. More so it has stuff to do with, like, fandom and, like, the writers constantly doing, like, creating situations to, you know, inflame divisions within fandoms across the Arrowverse. And it is super annoying that the whole Elicity baby reveal, because it's all being done for, like, drama. I don't care that the fact that they have a child. I thought it was, like I said last week, that, you know, if she's not Oliver's daughter, then I will just be shocked, because I don't see how they would call her Mia and them not be his daughter. But the whole drama that this will cause in fandom from now until the Crisis crossover is just annoying already. Before I was just assuming that maybe she would find out that she was pregnant either right before or during the finale of the crossover to kind of make, like, Oliver's impending death that much more dramatic. But this episode seemed to imply that she's pregnant now. And then, like May was saying earlier, like, I don't see how, like, the timing is very, like, weird to me about when she's going to give birth. Is Oliver in the picture? Is he not in the picture? The whole thing of, like, if she is pregnant now, how would she have hid this from Oliver all the way up to the crossover? If Oliver knew that she was pregnant and William just got sent off, like, I feel like he would want to, why would no one let William know that he's got a sister coming? It's, you know, all these little things that just don't really make any sense. And I feel like with the way that they are setting it up, it's either set up so that she gives birth in the premiere, if she's already a couple of weeks along, she's either set for, like, an October birth, or if she's just, like, freshly pregnant, then she's setting her up for a crossover birth, which we already know, and we've known for since last season, that West Allen was already on that track to, like, the whole series of The Flash is basically setting up for the Crisis crossover, for Barry's disappearance, for the twins being born. We had, since last season, the clue, we're going to need more diapers, being related to the Tornado Twins. Nora showing up last season, being part of this season. All of that is leading up to the Crisis crossover. And we have this, like, constant, like, cycle every crossover things that are promoted as Les Allen, such as their wedding, being kind of flipped at the last second to being about Oliver or Elicity or them being included in that moment. So them, like, having to share the wedding and now them possibly sharing pregnancy, what in, like, the next one, it's just, like, too much. And I think that, you know, no matter when Iris gets pregnant, like, if she gets pregnant this season or she gets pregnant at the beginning of next season, I would assume, like, speedster babies develop at faster than normal babies. So she would probably have, like, a short pregnancy anyway that would lead her up to being pregnant at the right time for the crossover. But, like, I don't know what's, like, worse, like, Barry and Iris sharing the pregnancy crossover death storyline with Elicity, or just, like, Elicity flat out taking that storyline from Les Allen and Les Allen not getting it at all. Like, Iris isn't pregnant at all, Barry doesn't die, and all of that drama and angst is just given to, like, Elicity, when it's something that the Flash has been building towards for the last, like, 5-6 years. Like, what, I don't even know how to describe which one is worse between the two of those. But it's just all, like, very, like, annoying, honestly. The end.
Do you have anything to add to that, Kathy?
I'm trying to think. I'm like, the prediction based on this is that the crossover is going to be about Oliver.
Yeah, pretty much.
What did our, someone had said something specifically about this. I think it was Shang, right?
Yeah, it was Shang.
I mean, I guess it's literally just, is this going to make the crossover about Oliver? Yes, yes, it is.
Yeah, the crossover was already going to be about Oliver. But
it's, like, it's always about Oliver.
You're right, they're always about Oliver.
Yeah, so, now, okay, here's one prediction. My prediction is that Laura will go back to being Black Canary because Dinah no longer has the range. So, now
the shame.
So, that. But relating to crisis or to pregnancies, I'm just hoping that the writers don't love trolling too much and leave us with, like, a double delivery room, because I feel like they might do it. I feel like they think it's hilarious.
I feel like they would definitely do that, and it's just, like, I don't know why they don't see that. No one wants this.
I think that they know, and that's why they think it's so funny. Because they know that people get so riled about it.
I hope they don't do it just because they probably saw that they got dragged even by, like, the media the last time they tried it. But I think I recall seeing some fans talking about how, like, oh, but Arrow is not imitating Flash. They've been building up to, like, Oliver and Felicity having a baby for years. I was like, no, they weren't. It's not like Oliver and Felicity were supposed to be the it couple of Arrow from the beginning to begin with. So, no, they didn't have this plan.
And, like, the thing is, if they were, like, if they had imploded the Laurel-Oliver relationship, all of these, like, firsts or whatever for Arrow would have been actual first and not, like, overlapping with Les Allen. Like, the only reason why they continue to overlap is because Arrow had to restart their show, basically, in season 3 to build up Oliver and Felicity to be, like, the new OTP. And so that's why they keep overlapping.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. That's very true. But, yeah, I think that at least this next year will be the last time that they can overlap.
I hope so. Yes. I just want...
That's what I predict. I'm predicting.
I think we can all just agree that we'd like a Flash storyline to stay a Flash storyline.
Right. I'm still not convinced that Oliver won't die this season, though, to be honest. But that's my prediction.
Okay.
I've not let go that the finale, he will probably die. Just because... It doesn't really seem to make, like, Oliver, like, Barry and Carr were supposed to die in this crossover, and when he made, like, the deal. So it doesn't really make sense why the Monitor would leave that deal for an entire year so that Barry and Carr don't die next year. Because it's like, they don't die twice. So I feel like the Monitor is going to have to collect on his promise earlier.
Then do you think they'll just bring him back?
Well, that's an interesting prediction.
Then would they would they just bring him back, like, resurrect him for the crossover somehow, or use another Earth Oliver?
Probably, but I don't, like, I feel like, because again, like, going back to Oliver knowing that he's got a daughter coming and not telling William about it doesn't really make sense to me. I still think there's an opening for that. And then it really doesn't matter when Felicity has Mia, whether she's a couple months long and
right.
gets both in the finale of this season or in the beginning of the next season as a single mom. Like, it doesn't matter. But anyways.
All
right. Oh, what were Tasha's predictions?
Okay, Tasha's predictions. She says, I think it's a bit strange that William says Felicity abandoned him when it's actually his choice to leave. He stated that Felicity just disappeared from his life, yet he knew her office wasn't Smoke Tech, which hasn't been established yet. So while I think she does keep in touch with him for a while, something horrible happens, and she realizes the only way to keep the kids safe is to keep them apart. Back in 708, Oliver made a random comment about the scroll and key. Mia has a giant key tattoo, so something tells me that William is a scroll portion of the equation. There is a reason Felicity's bringing them together now.
I agree with that.
Second, there is a rift between Renee and Dinah, and I think it's because of Emiko. I believe Dante killed her mother, and we know from the comics that his organization is very powerful. I have a feeling that Emiko is going to ultimately kill him, and then there will be a manhunt. Oliver, Renee, and the rest of the team will want to protect her, but Dinah will be conflicted because she's the police captain. Them being on opposite sides could explain the fight Dinah mentioned in 710. Way back in the prehistoric days of Season 1, we saw random things, like Walter buying Unidac Industries, and had no idea until the finale that it was the company that made the Earthquake Machine. I have a feeling they're doing that again this season. In an early episode, people were setting buildings on fire in the Glades, and someone was buying them up for cheap. I think it's the Ninth Circle, and that's the first step towards the rise of the Glades. Yes, I agree with
this. Yeah, I definitely agree with that one.
Lastly, I think / hope Season 8 is the last, and that these flash forwards are a two-season arc like Slade's. I believe Dante will be handled this season, but the Ninth Circle is who they will face 20 years in the future. I don't think Oliver's dead. He'll die in the next crossover, but be brought back, because if he dies to save the world, but Star City falls to ruin, then he didn't actually fulfill his hero journey on his own show. I think he's on the run / in hiding because of the Ninth Circle. Felicity's assembling the future team with Connor as Arrow, Mia as Speedy, William as Overwatch, and Zoe as Canary to help defeat them.
I didn't like in that little the new Team Arrow, the future Team Arrow. With.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
Alrighty.
All right. Excellent predictions, Tasha. Moving into Side B. Oh, no.
Side
Lady
A.
Lady of Gumption nomination for Side A. Who do we pick and why?
Crazy Jane?
Yeah, Crazy Jane.
She's the one with, like, the most, I guess, independence of the Doom Patrol.
Because mm-hmm. She definitely has, like, the most gumption, because she comes in like a rolling storm, and then when they're forced with the choice of fleeing the city or staying to, like, confront whatever evil's coming, and Cliff decides that he wants to stay, like, Crazy Jane is the one that, like, literally turns the bus around for Cliff, and has, like, a lot of, like, forward action. She moves the plot in, like, the later part of the episode, so I think she would be a good one.
I agree with that. Anyone from Arrow? Is there
Arrow. Mia?
Yeah.
She certainly has some gumption.
She definitely had a lot of gumption, like, smacking people around.
Exactly. She went out of her way to get those people gathered and to say what she wanted to say.
Yeah.
So there we go.
Moving into Side B, Deja Vu / Second Chances, we're going to start with The Flash, Cause and Excess. After Iris lands in serious danger, Nora races to save her mother. Barry puts the finishing touches on the metahuman cure off-screen, leaving Cisco with a rare night off, so he decides to take Camilla on a date. Rachel Talalay directed the episode written by Todd Helbing and Jeff Hirsch. What did we like about this Groundhog Day episode?
I mean, I like the concept of Groundhog Day. Like, in principle, like the fact that Nora would have to keep repeating stuff and using her reverse time skill over and over again to change in, like, one thing, and it just, like, switches up the players that were kidnapped and killed by Cicada. I like all that in principle. I like getting to see the inside of Central City Citizen. The office looks nice. Barry, like, picked up some more interior decorating ideas, put some paint on the walls, you know, it's looking good. I like the cute character moments that we got, like, for example, when Ralph, like, ate Iris ate Ralph's brownie. When Cisco was, like, mouthing, help me, to Nora, as, like, Ralph tries to peddle, like, romantic advice. I think of his revolving door of personalities that he was using to impress Camilla. The Instagram model influencer persona was probably my favorite. Basically because I thought his hair looked amazing. So that one was my favorite. But Camilla the Thriller was a little bit cringe. So, and I think in general, like, I feel like he was the real MVP for me, because without his vibe powers cluing him into something being off, like, Nora might still be looping in the timeline, going around and around in circles. So I like that while she's doing this and not telling anybody, which was dumb, he just, like, the way that his powers work clued him into something being wrong, and that bringing him back into, like, the main plot, I thought was really good. Probably my favorite dynamic, I think, was between Cisco and Nora. Barry being absent most of the episode made Tio Cisco the go-to stand-in for Nora's, like, weekly heart-to-heart. and I like that they genuinely seem to bond, like, over Electric Boogaloo, while also learning something to help both of their situations out. So I thought that was a really nice scene between them in the pipeline. And then this is kind of, like, minor, but, like, when she was trying to get everyone to stay put in Star Labs, and they're like, oh, well, no, I just got to go do something. And she's like, no! And she, like, kind of, like, patted and stomped her foot. I thought it was really cute, but I think that was more like a Jessica Parker Kennedy thing. And Nora being cute in the storyline, because but I thought it was really cute, so I put it in there.
Aww, I also actually really liked that moment, so I agree with you. It made me laugh out loud. Yeah, overall, I thought the premise sounded like it'd be amazing. Like, I was really excited for the episode, and then I, you know,
we'll talk about the episode.
Exactly. We'll talk about the execution on the flip side. But I did like the methodical way in which Nora kept changing, like, one thing every time to see if it would make a difference. I'm going to pretend that that's the scientific method CSI genes that she inherited from her dad. And I also thought that it was nice that, you know, like you said, Cisco's vibe-related deja vu and, you know, Iris's motherly instincts combined to help them figure out that Nora was doing stupid things with the timeline, and that once they were all clued in, they came up with an actually good plan to trap Cicada and all but kill him. For some reason, we just stopped short of taking him in, but again, talk about that later. I really liked Iris taunting him when like, you know, he went in there and she wasn't there, right? Because for some reason, he's like a robot that has to go into that room no matter what. And I like her having, like, sort of like a quote-unquote special dynamic with the villain that sets her apart in some way during the story. So I also appreciated small character beats and moments of continuity, like Ralph's Book of Love and how useless it is. And also Iris's brownie obsession rearing its head, right? Or Iris's sweets obsession where she, like, steals Ralph's. The reason Ralph was there to begin with, but that's all right. I thought that was a cute little moment. And of course, I greatly enjoyed Ian and Stefan. and the many times that that poor barista had to get their name wrong. I have a lot more to say about Cisco's plot in my dislikes than in my likes, but I did love seeing Carlos take on all the different personalities. And, like, you see Cisco's face, like, while he's on the date where he realizes that he's made a huge mistake, but, like, he can't stop now, he's gotta keep going. Like, well... The personality must continue because he's already dug the hole. He's already made his bed, he's got a lie in it, etc. And yeah, like you said, Nora stomping her foot and yelling no, that was like the funniest, one of the funniest moments in the episode. Because just like at some point, like she's super frustrated and concerned and scared, but like it comes across as just like this childish tantrum that she's having, right? Especially because the reason that she can give is, hey, my dad's to put me in charge for this 1 hour, so just stay in this 1 hour and don't fall into a hole somewhere. Like, okay. I also really enjoyed the Cisco and Nora talk, especially like the part specifically when he brought up the trauma of reliving Thawne's murder of him. I thought that was really powerful. Bit of acting from Carlos before it went somewhere else. But I also like Barry trying to be Jay in his speech about the timeline with Nora at the end, and the way that Nora was listening to him,
yeah,
with this like rapt attention of just like, holy shit, my mind is blown. I can't believe I didn't realize this. Does Amar know this? I'm gonna go ask him. So I thought that was cute.
Ambar does know this, and he does not care. yeah, I liked all of Cisco's failed first dates, and that his fear of being himself around Camilla kind of tied back a little bit to Cynthia, because I like some consistency. And I did think it was funny that everyone bailed on him as soon as Ralph whipped out his book. Like, first of all, I was just so happy to see Cisco, and him and his fabulous hair were the best parts of the episode. Like, his arc provided some nice insight into his feelings and also gave us some great Cisco moments, like Camilla the Thriller and his lies about being a gym buff, which were such major lies. I liked him and Camilla together a lot, actually, and like the shift between all of Cisco's other personas and his natural self meant a shift in Camilla's demeanor, and that said a lot about like how much she likes him already. And I think he really owned the episode, and it was great that he got so much focus. And I like that he and Nora got to bond, and that he told her that Eobard killed him in season one. And then, like, Nora briefly had the face of guilt and surprise before it passed. But it was a nice moment between them, and, like, shared love of Boogaloo and all. Cisco also called her a fangirl, which is what he called her in their meeting in last year's 13th episode, I think. So it was, like, a nice callback. And I liked seeing Iris' new office as well. And even though thought it was smart that Cicada actually did his own research, even though, like you said, he was like a robot going to the same office, but he tried. Like, now he knows who Iris is, and Grace knows who Iris is, or Nora is. So imagine how long it's going to take for everyone to put two and two together, or at least realize Barry's the Flash, but probably not until the 23rd episode. Anyway, I also like the development Nora got this episode, and that the timeline conversation paralleled the one Jay had with Barry in season 3. Like, I can't fault her for reversing time and wanting to fix things when we've seen Barry do so with bigger ramifications. I think she's so used to keeping secrets and only seeking the help of Eobard that she didn't even think to tell the team and put it upon herself to try and solve the problem, because that's probably what she thought Barry would do. So I like that the end result was a team effort, because going it alone was proving unsuccessful. Finally, for the brief moment that it lasted, I enjoyed the scene where they took down Cicada, because I thought they finally defeated him, and so the rest will be in my dislikes. But speaking of dislikes, what didn't we like about this episode?
That Cicada survived this episode is a huge dislike for me. Like, for why? Why is he still around? Why are we still dealing with him when Grace is, like, right there? Vaughn is, like, right there? Why am I still dealing with Orland? I don't understand. The fact that all six of them came together with this master plan to defeat him, and it worked, but then they just stood there, giving him time to fly away, it was just, like, super, super annoying. And it becomes even more annoying when, like, right after he flies away, Barry, like, immediately comes back successfully with a cooked cure. So it's just, like, you know, it's very obvious that the way that the writers did that was because they wanted to drag out the storyline even more. And why are you still doing that when you have two backup big bads that are more interesting than the one you have? I don't get it. Like, I don't understand why you want to drag this out so long. It's getting to, like, Savitar levels of story delays in that, like, it should have ended by now, and we're still seeing it, like, drag out to ridiculous amounts of time. You know, Cicada's just not going to show up again until, like, episode 20 or whatever, but because by then there would be zero excuse for not having cure to use on him. And then, like, the fact that, honestly, the next episode with Flash, with King Shark and Grodd, and then the episode description is basically that they went to go get King Shark's wife to help understand King Shark or whatever, and, like, well, that just sounds like we're gonna waste the one cure that we have on making King Shark human again. And so, once again, we can't use it on Cicada because we got to use it on this person. So, I mean, it's just, like, ridiculous at this point. The Flash is just officially has fallen into the old habits of keeping, like, secret reveals and big bad master plans and the big bads themselves long past their expiration date, all for the sake of stretching out a story over the course of 23 episodes when you could have done, like, arcs, multiple arcs in a season. It's possible with big bads. You can do it. I have faith in you, but not this season. It's just so frustrating. The season isn't going to shit because Team Flash defeated or Orlin or Cicada too early. Like, that's, like, I don't understand what they're afraid of. Like, it's not going to go to shit just because you defeated Orlin in episode 15. There's still other stories to be told. And Team Flash could really use this win, you know? Like, they fail. Flash is probably the worst at this, that they have Barry and the team fail for 20 episodes until they get it in the finale. And I think that the writer's insistence on dragging out these, like, storylines and making the team consistently take all these L's just makes everyone look incompetent. Like, everyone standing around while Cicada, like, growls in pain and then flies off. Just, you look dumb. Everybody looks dumb. And, like, while I like the concept of Groundhog's Day, the episode felt like it was missing a lot of, like, tension or humor. I feel like you have to go full force either one way or the other. And this episode felt like a half-assed both. Because, like, Groundhog's Day, the movie, there's a lot of humor, but there's a lot of dark comedy in there. And then when, like, Legends did it a lot better with the comedy and the tension and making it feel like there is something to be lost if Zari couldn't break out of the time loop. And there really, in The Flash, there really wasn't any tension in Cicada kidnapping and killing because, one, he's lame. Two, we already know that no one's going to stay dead. And three, there's not enough time for Nora or any of the other characters to actually, like, grieve the people when they die before Nora reverses time. Like, the only one that kind of, like, got me was maybe, like, when Killer Frost was like, no, when Ralph died, and that was, like, the best death, honestly. But then she goes back and reverses it immediately, so there's no kind of way to sit with it for a while and sit with the fact that these people are dying. And then after she does it the first time, it just makes zero sense why she wouldn't go and tell the team about it, the threat, rather than trying to, like, puppet master everyone and staying put for reasons that she doesn't want to disclose. And I think I would have liked for her, like, after the first time, like, she goes and she freaks out. She tells everyone, like, flat out, like, don't go anywhere because Cicada, blah, 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 blah. And then maybe, like, they don't believe her or think, like, she's overreacting because Barry's gone. It's a big responsibility. Nora, I know you're just, like nervous about being on your own, but it's going to be fine. And then it would have made sense for her to be like, I'm not even going to bother telling you guys because you're not going to believe me anyway. Either that, or honestly, I would have rather, like, maybe it started out as, like, a fever dream of Nora's, like, growing anxiety at defeating Cicada, or having to do this, you know, by herself while Barry's gone, and then that kind of, like, her dream fears manifest into, like, reality in the back half of the episode. I think that could have been a way to go with it, to kind of, you know, you start out and it kind of ratchets up the tension that this is actually real, like, someone could actually die, that kind of thing. That would have been one way to do it. The other way was, I think, to be, again, be a little bit more Legends about it and play up the black comedy of random members of Team Flash dying repeatedly and Nora being too slow to stop it. I feel like they could have made it, like, a funny thing instead of, like, a dramatic thing. And I feel like they infused some comedy into the Cisco Camilla date scenes. But rather than really being funny, the fact, like, seeing Cisco coming up with all these different personas, the fact that Camilla and the Generous Baristas didn't find it funny made the scene seem less funny. It was just, like, kind of cringe in a bad way instead of cringe in a funny way. And also, like, I don't get, like, by the way, like, Ralph and Cisco, but mostly Ralph, because it was his stupid idea. Did y'all ever stop to think that these men were Camilla's exes for, like, a reason? There's a reason that she...
That's not right. That's, like, the first thing I said. I was like, they're her exes.
Yeah, they're her exes. She didn't like them, obviously, for long. Like, I know, like, Ralph meant well, but I was just kind of a little annoyed that his book of love, like, psyched Cisco out enough to keep, for him to keep, like, trying his, like, ridiculous personas rather than, like, being himself.
I totally agree with that. I mean, like, to begin with, the way that it was introduced the first time around, when the book of love had, like, 27 steps, and then 27 was, like, realized she's not the love of your life if she's not in it anymore or whatever. And I was like, oh, he had a point this whole time. But this time he did not have a point. So it was, like, regression for Ralph. Like, suddenly Ralph does not understand anything. And then the way that they were, I don't know, it was kind of weird because Cisco was first staring at her photography, right? And then Ralph had those printouts of her ex-boyfriends. So they're like, are you cyber-stalking her? And I was like, didn't they both technically do the same thing? It's just that Ralph interpretation was much stupider than Cisco's. Like, I feel like they both just looked at social media and then were like, here are the conclusions I will draw.
Wait, yeah, I know you now. I've seen your social media. I know who you are.
So while I understand Cisco being insecure, like having to get back out there after Cynthia, I don't understand the manifestation of it. I don't feel like this was a believable or realistic interpretation of how Cisco would act when he feels insecure, even with the incentive of Ralph being dumb and showing him all these ex-boyfriends. Because it's like, first off, like logically speaking, when she gave you her number, you were talking about science. Like, yeah. Like, very clearly, she was like, oh, I like what I see here. She wasn't like, ah, I bet that guy's a gym rat. Or, oh, man, I bet he's a social media influencer. Like, clearly, she was like, ooh, this dude is looking, like, doesn't belong in this bar. And also, maybe discovered the cure for cancer. I want to date him. And even after, like, once he started getting the vibes, he was literally seeing her say that she wanted him to be a sexy brain. And she wasn't looking for Brown. And yet he's still, like, literally the one he went with after that was social media influencer. I was like, what? At the very least, go with, like, I'm the head of cancer research at this hospital. Like, go, like, the other extreme, you know? It just didn't make sense. Like they kept playing the same joke, even though I feel like Cisco would be smart enough to figure it out after a particular time.
And in fact, like, in the middle of the day, like, when he sees the vibe saying that she wants sexy brain. Be like, yeah. I'm sorry, I was just nervous, and then, like, reveal himself.
There's no reason for him to continue barreling. Right. Yeah, it's silly. And then also, like, just going to the point that Cisco wants a normal life, and he can't have a normal life because of the team and because of being on The Flash, etc. Like, if that's where we're going, right? Like, we're just assuming that Cisco's going to leave by the end of the season. So if that's true, then Cisco should have been having a very nice date that kept getting interrupted by Nora's cycle, right? Mm-hmm. And so then, like, he's not able to even have a decent conversation with Camilla because he has to go back to work. And instead it was just like, well, he's doing it to himself. And then also, just side note, there's also this, you know, situation. So I don't know. I think that there's other ways they could have played it while still being funny. Speaking of which, like, you guys, like, Groundhog Day was, like, a dark comedy, right? So, like, there's, like, the dark humor that you'd expect to see in an episode like this if that's the way you want to go with it. And for some people, like Cammie, who really enjoyed this episode, she is our friend and also our listener, so shouting her out. She was like, well, it was a comedy. That's why, you know, it was meant to be funny. It wasn't meant to be serious, and that's why I enjoyed it. But I was like, but I didn't, like, I personally, like, the humor didn't land for me. I felt like there was something missing from it. They didn't, like you said already, Jessica, they didn't lean into it enough. And also, since I was expecting something more like Enter Flash Time, or something more like Here I Go Again, where it's, like, the buildup of the frustration and, like, the inability to save anyone is so overpowering that, like, you really feel that in the performance. And I don't know, like, I feel like Jessica Parker Kennedy was doing her best, but, like, nothing was backing her up. Like, she's getting more and more frustrated, but, like, nothing else feels urgent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even the way that they showed her running back in time, it just felt like, oh, well, I guess I'm going to run back in time now, you know? Like, there wasn't even that moment of, like, pain or agony or just, like, helplessness after Caitlin died in the first one. And maybe it's also the fact that, like, literally the dagger, like, barely sticks in there. It just, like, goes, and now they're dead. And I was like, is that really going to kill anybody? And then, of course, it didn't kill Cicada, even though, so I guess it doesn't really kill anybody, just main characters necessarily, so that she can go back in time. So yeah, I was like, at the very least, like, show us, like, the moment of struggle or something, you know? Like, not just, like, and they're dead. And scene. It's like, you know, I always say this, but, like, the Brooklyn Nine-Nine scene, where they're like, we're gonna act out this murder, okay? Hello, I'm the victim. And dead. Like, that's what I felt like. Oh, okay. But not in a hysterical way, because, again, I wasn't laughing. I was just like, wait, that's it? That's it? So, yes. The only, like, real comedy that I felt was happening, or it really, because it wasn't funny enough, it, like, only served to underline how not serious the situation was that Cisco kept comparing his failed date to Nora having to watch everyone she knows die. Like, even in that scene where first he's talking about, like, oh, yeah, I remember reliving Dawn killing me, but also, listen, I totally understand what you're going through, because for 52 times I have tried to impress Camilla by being a dumbass. Like, no, it's not San Francisco. I don't understand. So yeah, I don't know. I felt like there's just like something missing from the episode. And this was written by Todd Helbig, and so was Enter Flash Time. So I don't know. I don't know what went wrong here.
No, maybe it's just Enter Flash Time was
Sterling and Sterling Gates.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I guess maybe Jeff Hirsch was the missing link here that couldn't stick it.
You're
blaming it on Jeff Hirsch.
Or something. I don't know. Like something was not right. Yeah, it just was lacking. It was lacking urgency. It was lacking, like, emotion, whatever. And what I was going to say is, like, I feel like it must just be because Cicada is a worthless villain and it doesn't make any sense why Nora alone couldn't stop him, let alone Nora and one other person, or Nora and two other people. And of course, the idea that she had to do it 52 times, this is, at the very least, give us, like, a montage of that.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess they did, but, like, I didn't know, it just looked like a montage of what
just,
had already
yeah,
happened.
Yeah, it was just, like a little blip, instead of it being, yeah. like, a good, and again, and just, like, it being increasingly funny that yeah. Nora can't stop it.
Yeah, and, or, like, yeah, like, the first time, you give us the full length, right, like, it takes 5 minutes to get to the first death, okay, to build that up, that tension. And then with each time, make it faster, make it, like, we yeah. get to that end point faster, but instead they kept doing the exact same thing over again, which brought down the,
And Cicada had to do his, like, long, drawn-out, big, bad speech every time. Yes. Like, oh my god.
Yes. And then also just, like, the fact, like, I don't understand why he keeps walking into that office no matter who's in it already. Like, isn't there any sign outside of, like, the fact that Iris isn't there? Like, I don't know. And then, like, one time, he goes in, no one's there, so he sees the Cecile thing, right? But then another time, no one was there, and then he didn't look at the Cecile thing. He just walked out. And I know it was because he just walked out because then Iris is going to come out and be like, ha-ha, psych, right? But there's no other reason why he wouldn't look at the Cecile thing. He could have had the plan to go to Cecile and then Iris stopped him, but and that's just, like, a minor point, but I'm just, like, Cicada's just acting like what they need him to act like. He's not actually acting yeah. based on how he actually would. Speaking of, that was, I think, one of the big problems, is, because, again, the episodes I keep comparing it to are Enter Flash Time and Here I Go Again, and in Here I Go Again, the loop that Zari was in, like, at first was like, why is she in this loop? And then you find out, and the reason is because it's created by Gideon, right? It's not even real. It's, mm-hmm. it's on purpose by Gideon. So then you're like, okay, that makes total sense. Thank you. And in Flash Time, you see, like, the tension every single time, right? Like, everything that Grant does is, like, just, like, literally, he's, like, soaked with the tension of having to save people, right? And the event is so catastrophic that, like, yeah, of course, there is no way that he could stop it on his own. So you understand why Barry is going to need all this help. But then with this one, first, there's no reason for the loop. Like, she can't go back past that point just because she can't. Like, performance anxiety, that's why. Just because the writers decided she can't go back past that point. There's no explanation. And then she can't get into the Speed Force to ask her dad for help. Because the writers want it that way. Like, again, there's no explanation. She's like, I just can't get in. Okay, oh well. You know? If there was some correlation, I don't know, to Ea Bard or something, then maybe they'd be like, oh, okay, I get it. But instead, it's just there. They didn't even bother trying because they're lazy. And, like we said, Cicada should be so easy to stop. Now that we've seen that Iris can just stab him. Pain. And she told them, too. So I don't know why Nora didn't just try stabbing him. Like, you're super fast. Get to him faster and stab him. But anyway. So again, like, there's no explanation for why she needs to go through all these tries before she asks.
And they stabbed, like, when the team actually got together, they stabbed him in the back, right? With the
yeah,
dagger.
They stabbed him on the wrong
back instead of in his chest where it should have been.
No, they stabbed him, like, on the wrong side of the chest. It was like not the one that had the sparkly whatever, the shard.
No, right, the front, but it was from the wrong side on the front.
It was on
idiot.
The,
so
yeah.
Yeah, like, thanks for nothing. Thanks. And even then, there was still enough time to grab him because they were, you know,
exactly
slow mo and everything. So whatever, it's just stupid. So yeah, again, the fact that they didn't stop Cicada this episode is also a problem because this was the perfect place to stop Cicada. This is, like, bad plotting. And then finally, even after hearing the story of the Reverse Flash killing Cisco, she still goes back to Ea Bard and continues to trust him. And also, like, she's like, I need to know that what we're doing is not going to make things worse, right? And I was like, what are y'all doing? You're on episode 14. It has been 14 episodes, and y'all haven't done shit. And he says that you're going to stop Cicada, but what has he provided to stop Cicada? You've been sending him your little diaries every single day, or every single week. I don't know how often you've been sending him little diaries, and coming to visit him, like, once a month, for, like, weird friendship time, and he has provided no things. Like, I don't understand. The only thing he ever did was, like, tell you you could go back in time to see your dad. And everything else has just been Nora. So I don't understand what the plan is here.
I don't even know if the writers understand what the plan is anymore. Like, that's how, like, convoluted it's gotten.
I mean, just, like, to compare, like, how in season one we saw Eobard doing something, like, every episode that had, like, two meanings, right? Like, what he shows to the characters and then what he shows to the audience. So we see how everything's a double-edged sword. But here it's like we don't see anything. He's just hanging out in his cell, yelling at Nora sometimes and whispering other times. And just be like, trust me, I will save your father from this cell, doing nothing.
And per Jessica, his hair keeps getting blonder too, so we don't know what's really happening in that cell.
I don't know if it's like intentional or if it's like the lighting or whatever, but I swear his hair is getting like blonder. I'm like, is he reverting back to Matt? He said, please.
Yeah, please.
If he's not, I don't want
it. Please, Matt, come back. I also love the concept of Groundhog Day style episodes, but like there was definitely a spark missing here. So like despite all the deaths, there were no real stakes. The impact of the deaths fell flat, and even some of the death scenes were really comical. Like I know that just like when Ralph died, but like the way he just kind of like fell forward, I was like, this is just so anticlimactic. It just didn't feel like there was any tension every time Nora went back to fix things. And unlike 5'10", I actually did notice Barry's absence in this episode. And there was like also a bunch of things that didn't make much sense or weren't explained because they were operating under the this is happening because we said so guidelines, like Tati said. The reversing time with Nora to a specific point made no sense. And then nitpick, but for all Iris is criticized for doing things that make sense, like working a computer in Star Labs, someone needs to explain why Sherlock, who isn't a scientist, knows more about the Speed Force in this episode than Barry does. So, like, Barry should have come up with that solution. The Speed Force is his, so let him have it and be smart about it, what it can and can't do, damn it. Like, this is 5 seasons, and he still has the Speed Force explained to him. I just don't understand. Anyway, at this point, I'm also a bit tired of Sherlock, period, but also mostly tired of him picking up on Nora's odd behavior before anyone else does. So, like, we see him notice odd things about how she's acting before other people do. And I think it would have made more sense for Iris to question why Nora was acting a bit strange and why she wanted her to stay in Star Labs so desperately, besides the, okay, like, I get it, and then just moving into the next scene. Because she's usually good at picking up on when there's something up with Barry, so I guess I don't see why the same wasn't the case for Nora. And I also thought it was odd that it took Sisko 52 times to realize something was off, too. Like, he kept vibing his date over and over. Why didn't he question whether he was seeing the future or, like, another timeline? Especially when at one point he was vibing, like, multiple versions of the date at the same time. And then when the episode opened and they were talking about the cure being ready in 29 days, I thought, great, we have to wait that long until Cicada is finally defeated. How convenient. But then they decided to take it into the Speed Force and it would be done in 60 minutes, which was exactly the amount of time Nora had to defeat Cicada too. So they could have made it so Barry could have run in with the cure just as Nora and the rest of the team stabbed Cicada. Problem solved. Barry gets to be the hero. It was a team effort. Bravo. Instead, Cicada just flew off to live another day and torture us with his presence for longer than necessary. So this is like the fourth time the team has had the chance to neutralize him. And once again, he flies off. It's really exhausting. And he doesn't really pose a real threat. So Grace is scarier than him, and so this episode would have really been the ideal time to take him down and move on to Thawne and Grace waking up from her coma. And finally, and this is probably a nitpick too, but it shouldn't have taken everyone that long to get to the rooftop the first time Iris sent out her distress signal. Like, Nora is a speedster, and Sisko hadn't even left for his date yet, so he could have just vibed there. She hit that panic button right when she saw Cicada's shadow, as did everyone else who ended up in that situation. And yet it took forever for everyone to make it there, making it look like Cicada moves faster than they do. I also found it interesting that Cicada wasn't interested in killing Iris, just using her to get to the metas. Like, she could write articles about him and send him to jail where he'd never see Grace again, and he seemed unconcerned. And I think it would have been interesting had they just repeated Iris being kidnapped, but like in different locations. Like if Cicada had done his research, he could have come to her office, but then the next time he could have just come to the apartment, and then the next time he could have just figured out that they were all just operating out of Star Labs, you know? So it didn't
that,
have to
that
be.
Yeah, that actually would have made like more of like attention, because it would be like no matter what Nora did to change like the location that Iris went to, like Cicada would always find a way to get to Iris.
And then she could just alter who helped her instead of just like Killer Frost first, and then it could just be Ralph and then whoever. So it was just underwhelming. But do we have any predictions?
Just like only that he's just going to mysteriously go disappearing for like the next four episodes because the Flash writers have not planned out what to do once he's defeated. And I feel like, again, like the story is like right there. Like as soon, I feel like it really, and I've put this on Twitter, and I think I answered one of the Anons on Tumblr about it. Like as soon as Orlin's defeated, Grace will wake up, and then you can get like Cicada Part 2. And I don't know why they're stalling on Cicada Part 2 when it's so much more interesting than Cicada 1.0.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. Like, I don't even know what to predict anymore regarding him, because it feels like they're not going to go anywhere with it until next season, right? Like, they'll just be like, oh, well, like, I guess other Cicada will come next season, or other Cicada will just only be in the future. Like, I don't know. And there's no point in predicting the Eobard stuff, because, again, they're just holding, that's just on hold. Everything's on hold. It's,
until the finale.
Yeah.
Or until, you know, whatever.
And so we're going to miss out on a lot of, like, really cool future storylines they could have done once you have Grace awake, and then you can, like, Nora can, like, go back to the future and see, like, that it's still messed up. We could get, like, whole tons of future storylines that we're just not going to get because they don't want to write it, so. Yeah,
exactly. This isn't really a prediction, but, like, her reversing... I know her reversing time 52 times was more of an Easter egg, but it should mean something, right? Like, she's already in a timeline where she doesn't belong, so how does that affect the timeline? Like, is it broken enough to give her a twin yet? Isn't this show a timeline within a timeline?
It's broken enough to turn Eobard's hair blonde again.
Like, is this timeline within a timeline now? Like, two timelines working together? And then I think I'll add that it would have been nice, just like you said, Jess, to see, like, future stuff. Like, what does 2049 look like? What damage has Cicada inflicted? Why is Nora, besides just, you know, trying to save her dad, why is she so desperate to, like, stay around in the future, besides just defeating Cicada? Like, obviously, the impact in the future, it would be nice to just see that, because that way it would parallel, like, the impact that's happening now, except we're being suffocated again, so hopefully
that would be copying Arrow May. We can't do that.
Oh, yeah. All right. Moving into Black Lightning. The Book of Secrets, Chapter 3, Pillar of Fire. Lynn works on two of the pod kids in a segregated safe room. Meanwhile, Jennifer plots revenge and Jefferson receives some interesting news about becoming principal again. And then lastly, Anissa makes a shocking discovery about Grace.
The episode description lies again because Lynn only works with Wendy.
Yeah.
Liars. Watch your own show, episode writer.
They're always lying about Lynn.
Yeah.
They are. And I feel like their summaries are also always the shortest. So, interesting. But what do we like about this episode of Black Lightning?
I think that in an episode in which Grace never shows up at all, it was really good for Thunder Grace Grace content, which is odd, but that's what it is. I thought Anissa being angsty and worried over Grace to the point that she searches, like, the apartment for clues, and it's, like, really, like, it actually tells her family members about her girlfriend. Is the content that I signed up for. I like that this episode finally gave us some good backstory into who Grace is, even if that backstory turned out to be really sad. We also now know about the pills Grace is taking and possibly the reason why she's taking them. I do wonder if she's misunderstanding her condition, like she thinks that she has schizophrenia, because it's just weird. Like, why else would her skin and stuff be freaking out like this?
Right.
But maybe she doesn't understand, like, her powers and that she's actually, like, a meta. And so she's using this as kind of, like, a placebo for her condition. And I hope the storyline continues to be this consistent with Thunder Grace and Anissa's feelings for Grace through the finale. Because I feel like this is what we should have been getting, like, from the get-go when they introduced her and building it up to this point. I like the peer sisters bonding and having each other's backs, even when the younger one is being stupid and reckless. I must not have realized exactly when Innocent moved into the old family house, because I thought she was still living at the Pierce house with Jefferson, Lynn, and Jennifer. But I was glad to see that it was a space where Jen could come and feel safe and stay with Anissa and kind of like a home away from home. So I'm glad that her parents let her out of the house enough to go right. to the other house. I feel like Anissa treated her hard-headed sister like an adult, and that she didn't belittle or downplay Jennifer's feelings about losing Khalil. And even when Jen ultimately ignored her advice and went out in search of vengeance anyway, Anissa had her sister's back and put Jen's health and safety above being, like, mad or upset at her going off on her own. And I really appreciate Anissa for that. And I love that big sister side of her. As far as Jennifer, I like that we're moving closer to her getting her own suit, and we're seeing how that develops. And even at like 50%, like that first opening sequence when she's in like Jen in a box and she's at 50% strength and she's more powerful than Jefferson was in his prime. And she just seems to have come a long way, even when she's on like her vengeance thing, baby Blackbird, you know, like throwing people against the walls or whatever. You see like the way that she's learned to control her powers and her little like lightning lassos. It's come a long way since she first figured out that she had powers. So I like all of that this evolution of Jennifer's abilities. And the fact that she was able to like short circuit the sanctum, I thought was pretty impressive. Not even trying, really. She's just like, I don't know. And she was able to do that. So I thought that was really impressive. Tobias and Cutter, it's a thing that's happening, you know? I think the actors definitely have some chemistry. And I'm nervous for Cutter, but she's dated Tobias before and survived. So, yay.
That is something.
That speaks a lot to her, that she was able to, like, date him, and then they broke apart, and she still survived. So, you know, that I have high hopes for her. More importantly, though, I like their partnership. I like their partnership, and that they actually woke up one of the Masters of Disaster. So that they're definitely not elongating storylines past their expiration dates or whatever. They're actually like waking up the Masters of Disaster, and we're getting that movement consistently episode after episode now that Tobias finally has like a plan. Marcus Bishop, aka Shakedown, I thought I'm really interested in his whole backstory, and especially his relationship with Dr. Jace. I still don't like Dr. Jace, but I like that she seems to have solidly moved over to Team Tobias and that she's now more of an active villain. Whereas before, I think she was a little bit of a passive villain, so I like that she's now moved into this active role. And I'm excited to see the Masters of Disaster start the actual disaster part of the plot. It's really interesting to me that we also finally know what Tobias wants. And, like, he wants to be, like, the premier metahuman arms dealer of the world. And so that's, like, a clear plan that we didn't have before. Cutter and Shakedown managed to successfully steal all the Pod Kids. Like, Markovia is shaking because they could not do that. They can still win. And Cutter and Shakedown stole, like, all the kids in one swipe. And, like, the kids being stolen into the metahuman trafficking is the whole theme of Young Justice right now. The Flash had an attempted meta-slave trade storyline with Amunette, and now Black Lightning has his own metahuman slave trade storyline. So it'll be interesting to see how their take on it and where their morality falls on it within the show. So that'll be cool. And I'm kind of glad there's no longer this weird like tension or love triangle thing with Cutter, Todd vying for like Tobias's attention. So like when she like killed him, I was like, bye, Todd. I was not sad.
Okay, so he did die. I wasn't imagining.
He did die.
Okay, yeah.
He did die. She said Todd got a new car, and then you see a car with like a black hand. And I think they just didn't want to cut RJ Cryer a check to die in the episode, which is kind of like, it's kind of like disrespectful. Like, you're an actor on a show, and then you don't even get to be in the episode that you die in.
Yeah.
You're just like, bye, Todd. But I think that, you know, the hand is supposed to be like, that's Todd, and then the car blew up, so. Bye, Todd.
Bye, Todd.
Oh, I'm going to miss RJ Siler, though.
Exactly. Anyway, as always, I love their opening music. They're always great. Black Lightning, music supervisor, needs a raise. I also really enjoyed the, you know, I'm enjoying Jennifer's powers and them, like, sort of, like, going through the process of discovering just how powerful she is. And Gambi poking fun at Jefferson for getting old. It was really cute. And I like the reminder of
his mortality.
Of their friendship. Well, his mortality, no, but of their friendship. What I was going to say. So it's been, like, a little bit awkward ever since, you know, the reveal. And then, like, they haven't really had much time to enjoy themselves because they've been busy, like, chasing after Jennifer or, you know, trying to stop Pod children from exploding. So it's just nice for like a brief second. Also, I really liked all of the Jennifer and Anissa bonding that I got this episode. Like you said, it was nice to see Jennifer getting to spend time in the home away from home, having a little sleep over her sister, and also the way that they were both like listening to each other's problems, even if Jennifer was like, for once, Jennifer was the one that was being a little bit difficult. Not for once, she's difficult for a couple of episodes, but I mean with Anissa. Because usually she, like, before, she knew exactly what to say about Grace, despite not having met her, being like, oh, you're soul food. But now she's like, maybe she just don't like you. I don't know. And I was like, okay, that's a little weird. But it was nice to hear Anissa get to talk to her about it, and also to support her with Tobias. Like, I was surprised, but, like, in a good way, when Anissa was like, oh, I will totally help you kill Tobias. You know, just gotta wait it out. When we can kill him, we totally will. And I was like, yes. And then, of course, I enjoyed a little comedic beat of, like, don't go anywhere, where would I go? And then the next scene is, of course, where Jennifer goes, that is not staying in place. anyway, I also liked that, kind of like with Anissa the other day, like, she learned a lesson, Jennifer learned a lesson about being too reckless without having to deal with, like, extreme consequences, right? Like, I don't want anything super bad to happen to her, but she got to see that was probably not the way to deal with the problem. I really liked Anissa being actively worried about Grace and Gambi helping her out, you know, like, and actually agreeing to do all those things, and just taking the situation seriously, right? It's a little bit creepy when you're, like, testing your girlfriend's medication and stuff, but her life is in danger. And for whatever reason, like, you can't go to the police. So it's like, I was like, I understand what's happening right now. And I like that Anissa is treating Grace like a very important part of her life. Because in the past, when Grace disappears for episodes, it would not be a relevant plot point, and we would not know the status of their relationship at all until Grace 3 appears.
Progress.
So, exactly. I love progress. Also, yeah, I just like that we've sort of, like, taken turns seeing both Anissa and Jennifer be really hard-headed and stubborn and reckless in the pursuit of what they care about or in the pursuit of what they want, just because it's like, oh, the Pierce girls are really very much alike. Surprise. Anyway, Devon talking to Jefferson and inspiring him and giving him a, you know, second chance with Garfield High, I really love that scene. I was like, yes, fight, Jefferson! And then we found out that the video went viral. I love that because it's what I was hoping would happen, right? I was like, I can't wait for everyone to see this video and know this guy is trash. So I was, like, really hyped for Jefferson, like, standing up for the kids, like, taking back the school, or at least, like, replacing What's-His-Face with a great principal. So that did not happen. But when I thought that it was going to happen, I was really excited. I'm glad that the Pod people are waking up, right? We got to meet Marcus, and I'm looking forward to seeing what Dr. Jace really does on Team Tobias, right? And how that changes their dynamic and also, like, pushes the story forward now that we've got some Masters of Disaster action. And I wrote that I liked seeing Lynn get a bit of a win with Wendy. I don't remember what happened. I've already forgotten, but I must have liked it at the time when I wrote it.
She managed to call for help and get her out of the, yeah.
Oh, that's right. That's right. She helped that girl. That's right. And then Jefferson came in time. I love that. Okay. I don't know why I forgot that, but yes. Probably because I don't remember the name Wendy. I was like, who the fuck is Wendy? But yes, I really liked that part. I did like. I was about to let me save somebody. Jesus. Okay.
Woohoo.
Here we go.
I think Anissa was really like the MVP of the episode, between investigating Grace and being there for her sister, both emotionally and physically getting out of her trouble. It was really great. And I really think Nafisa Williams has stepped up, because she really conveyed more sincerity in her performance while worrying and looking into Grace's absence. And I also really like that she didn't get mad about Grace keeping secrets from her, because she thought it would be unfair to judge her, knowing she'd kept being Thunder a secret from her as well. So that was very mature, and I could really feel how much she's developed in this relationship with Grace, even if it's a shame we're seeing most of it when Grace is now gone. Learning that Grace's real name isn't even Grace, and that her backstory was really traumatic, was upsetting, surprising, and sad. So I didn't really like it, but I didn't like hearing that it was so traumatic, but I liked that we're getting some consistency with her story, and how it's like slowly tying into some of the Markovian plot, or could potentially tie into the Markovian plot. I liked seeing Lynn stand up to Agent Odell, and that she agreed to help move the pod kids, but only if she didn't work with Dr. Jace anymore. Dr. Jace working with both sides before she chose one side provided the episode with some great tension. And then finally, I really liked the speech the student gave to Jefferson about second chances. I know he beats himself up and feels guilty about seeming like he wasn't there when the school needed him most, but sometimes you have to see yourself through the eyes of others, and I think he needed to hear that he is still appreciated no matter how much he thinks he shouldn't be the principal at the moment. And I forgot to add that I also really appreciated the sisterly moments between Jen and Nissa. I thought they had some great bonding time. But what did we not like?
I feel like Jen shouldn't always say what's on her mind. She's a little too honest sometimes. And like the whole thing with Nissa, like stressing out and worrying about Grace and if she's okay, and Jen's first thought is just like, maybe she's just not that into you. It kind of reminds me of earlier in the season when Lynn was having a hard time starting to like spiral after some of the pod kids died. And Jen, like in the middle of Lynn's spiral, Jen's basically like, well, it's your fault. But then she wants like people to be understanding for her and her feelings and her mourning over Khalil. And it's like, not very understanding of like other people's feelings, but then wants people to be understanding of her feelings.
Like, that doesn't really work. Entitlement.
That's not how that works, Jennifer. So, yeah. I also didn't like that after Anissa validated Jen's feelings, promised to help Jen, promised to come up with a plan. She didn't say like Jefferson, like you can't kill Tobias. She's like, we are going to kill Tobias, and we're going to do it together. But right now, we need to like lie low and plan. And she made sense. Like, she did all of these things. Explained why they shouldn't run off half-cocked and have a plan. And as soon as she leaves, Jen does it anyway. And the most frustrating thing is that she went after a man that has haunted her dad for over 20 years. A man that Jefferson has never beaten. With absolutely no plan. But her vengeance and her rage. She's not been training to fight. She's had the same amount of, like, combat training, you know, street training that Anissa had in the beginning, because we knew, like, when she, in the pilot episode, when she was in the 100 Gangs Club, and she had to, you know, whatever that guy's name that was trying to force her into prostitution, she had to check him real quick. So we know that she can, like, do some of that. But as far as going against, like, a crime boss with no kind of training and no control over your own powers, I thought that was just really like reckless. And for Jennifer to be such a smart girl, I understand that she's like mourning, but that just kind of didn't really make any sense when like Anissa had already gone through like the logical steps of this is what we need to do to get vengeance on Tobias. So I didn't understand like why that she thought she could go out and like find him and kill him like tonight. Like, the first scene, when she shorted out the power in the Sanctum, just shows you, like, how dangerous her powers can be. And I honestly thought that she was going to accidentally kill one of the 100 gang, like, looking for him. Like, she's out here, like, where's Tobias? And, like, choking people with her lightning. I thought she was going to kill somebody. But even then, like, I don't even know if she would have been deterred by the fact that she had just killed somebody. Because she was already planning on killing Tobias. So I don't even know, like, if they had gone that route and had her actually kill somebody, I don't even know that she would care. And that's not really, like, I don't really like that direction that she's going in. And I really hope Perrina can help her find more positive outlets for her anger, because this ain't it. I don't like it. And then you have the school storyline, which felt off to me. I thought having Jefferson defend Lowry to the board was bullshit, mainly because I feel like the writers should have picked a lane for how they wanted this rivalry between Lowry and Jefferson to play out. So either you pick the lane that he's a racist and that he doesn't care about the children of Garfield High, he doesn't care about minority kids, black and brown kids in this area, and, you know, reverse racism and all that other shit, and you build up Napier, who's also, like, on the board, and he was in the first few episodes. You build him up alongside the Lowry storyline, and then when Jefferson realizes that he cannot handle being principal and doing what he has to do with Black Lightning, Napier's right there to step in as the person that can do that and bring the stability for those kids, but not Lowry. Or you take the General Haley route, where Lowry is this, like, tough love guy that's unlikable and kind of an asshole, but he's also not racist, and he actually cares about the kids despite the appearance to the contrary. So he's got, like, this hard-line stance, but he's not hard-line because he doesn't care about black and brown kids. He's hard-line because these kids need stability or whatever. But Jefferson advocating for Lowry to keep his job in that situation, in the situation that they went with going, basically, like, choosing both lanes and like, straddling lanes, it makes Jefferson seem, to me, a little bit selfish and defending Lowry and giving Lowry the job. Like, I get why he can't be the principal, but it also just feels like he's abandoning the school to prioritize his own self-interest. Because Lowry's still not the best person for those kids. And I don't like that they're trying to, like, make it that he is, because he's not. It'd be one thing if he's leaving the school in the hands of someone that actually cared about it, but there's no indication that Lowry is that person. That aside, I also don't like the dynamics between, on the villain side, Jace and Tobias and Shakedown and all the pod kids. Like, the whole Suicide Squad thing with, like, the watch bombs being implanted in the brains to control Marcus. I know I said, like, the Metahuman's arms dealer storyline was interesting, but just, like, with Shakedown and his face when he sees that Tobias is working with Dr. Jace, of all people, it really speaks volumes to me. And it's definitely like a modern-day slavery thing. And considering Tobias's views on black people in general, plus his business plan to become a metahuman arms dealer, slave trader, basically, when most of those stolen kids are black and brown kids, it just all kind of leaves a little bit of a bitter taste in my mouth. And so I'm wondering where the show really wants to go with that.
Yes. I agree with the last part, that it's an uncomfortable dynamic for sure, especially considering who Tobias is and what he's been, what he's behaved like in the past. And I don't know that they'll make it a thing. Like, it would be one thing if they were going to make actual commentary out of it. But the way that they've done Tobias so far, it's kind of just been like one-liners. So I don't know if they'll actually make it a plot line or make it part of the story. But speaking of Tobias, and on a much less serious note, while I agree that he and Cutter have a ton of chemistry, I thought it was really random that they started making out in the middle of the scene, especially when he was like, especially, like, I trust you because Tori trusted you. Anyway, so yes, so the fact that he brought up Tori right before made me think for a second that she and Tori were a thing, and then that was not the case, and then they made out, and then I was just thinking about Tori and how sad it was that they just killed her off for no reason, out of nowhere. In the middle of season one, when there was still so much more she could have done. So, yes. Moving on. While I agree that it was good that we got to hear about Grace's identity and backstory, it was super upsetting. I was like, why is her life so sad and awful? And, like, even more so, like, she wasn't there to, like, reveal it or, like, you know. Like, there could have been an episode where we got to see that backstory, you know? Or got to, like, whatever. Basically, it's a whole more Grace, and then there's, like, here's a whole info dump on Grace, but we're not going to see Grace, because reasons. So I didn't like that. And I also agree, Jennifer is being too reckless. Even if she's upset about Khalil, it's, again, another situation where it doesn't feel really believable that that's the way she would act. Like, yes, be very angry, and yes, feel very helpless, but we see her containing herself in other situations, like even in these episodes, these like post-Khalil episodes, we see her like reacting maturely at certain times, or even if she's doing something that's kind of reckless, like when she's standing up with the principal, it's, like, done with purpose, and that she has, like, backup for it or whatever, you know? And then you've got her on the flip side, like, going after the big bad all on her own, like you said, with no plan. So it just kind of feels like it's an instance of prioritizing what they've decided they're going to do. Like, the arc is, like, Khalil's death will lead to Jennifer wanting vengeance over what Jennifer as a character would actually do, considering that she was someone who, before Khalil, was very wary of her powers. So he inspired her to take hold of them. But now that he's gone, I feel like it would be something like her and Perrina trying to redirect her powers rather than her just going off on her own. Like Jessica said very eloquently. Anyway, I really, really did not like Jennifer standing up for Lowry on the basis of his stability speech. Like, I didn't like that Jefferson decided that Lowry had a point, and that the show decided that Lowry had a point, and had Jefferson back him up like that as if it was the right choice. Like, it made it feel like they're like, yeah, Jefferson needs to step back because he's too invested in his Black Lightning-ness, so, like, he's sometimes missing. Like, sometimes he's not going to be there. And I was like, yeah, but the times that he's there are going to be much more helpful to the kids than Lowry. Like, Lowry being there all the time isn't going to help anybody. It's just going to regress them, right? And like you said, like, we've already established that he's racist. At the very least, he thinks reverse racism is real and that no one has it harder than the white American male. So clearly, problems. We don't want him being the leader of this school. And yet, I don't know, I just felt like it was like a sharp right left turn or whatever, you know, out of nowhere. Definitely not where I thought the storyline was leading. I also, speaking of, like, you know, save the children, I wish that we could save more children. I don't like that we're this far into the season and we're not getting very many wins. I feel like it's still sort of like, not like spinning its gears. Like you said, it is moving faster, like we're waking up the podcast finally, but the Markovians are still just kind of like in the background somewhere. Like, I still don't know shit about Markovia. And then things like Todd's car exploding and Todd now being dead. Like, I was like, what is the point of Todd then? Why did we ever bring in Todd? What did he do? Other than, like, Google Markovia. I don't understand. couldn't Tobias have done that alone or, like, hired someone just off screen to do it?
He,
like,
opened,
oh, well,
the
guess
suitcase,
what,
Tati.
What?
He opened the suitcase.
Yeah.
You're right. He opened
the suitcase. That was his
whole purpose. Opening the suitcase. That's
and I think Cutter actually listed all of his accomplishments before she killed him.
Yeah,
they listed out everything that he was supposed to do, and they're saying, no, now he's done it, and we don't need him anymore. Goodbye.
Yeah. So it was just kind of like, I was like, all right, well, I feel like it was a waste. It was like a waste of RJ Styler as an actor to bring him in just for like a couple of like zingers and Googling or opening of suitcases. But yeah, so I didn't like that. It was just kind of random. I thought he was going to go somewhere as well, but he did not go anywhere. Which, whatever. Like, I like Cutter. She's cool. But hopefully she doesn't die, like everyone else on Tobias's team.
Same. Yeah, it was definitely weird seeing Cutter and Tobias together. I think especially considering the way that he's, like, spoken to her before, I guess, like, in this kind of disrespectful manner. And I didn't like the fact that Jefferson finally had the opportunity to take his job back and didn't, especially after that speech. One of his students gave him about second chances. Like, that should have been the light bulb. You know, that he would just be like, yeah, I need to take this back. Because just because he wasn't personally ready or felt worthy to be principal again, like you guys said, doesn't mean Lowry and his attitude toward the student is the best thing for them either. So, like, all I can think about is how the kids would react if they found out he had the opportunity and didn't take it back, given all that's happening. So, like, when exactly does Jefferson think he'll be ready? Because the Black Lightning business isn't going to go away anytime soon, not with a new threat and Tobias still out there. So, like, when is he going to be principal again? I also didn't like that we still don't get to see the Markovians. Like, Tobias is doing the heavy lifting in this episode, and the Markovians at this point are starting to sound like a myth. Like that scary story your parents tell you is like, oh, they're such scary people, but like you never see them. R.I.P. Todd, because he went and died so abruptly before he could even really begin working with Tobias. And I will miss you, RJ. And And then finally, I know Jen very badly wants her revenge, but she still hasn't gotten control of her powers. And Inessa did make a good point. Like, Tobias is a man even Jefferson hasn't been able to take down. So going in hopped up on anger is only going to get her killed. And I also wanted her to be a bit more sympathetic toward Inessa, like Jess said, especially since she's been there for her these last couple of episodes. So, like, if Inessa feels there's something going on with Grace that isn't right, then just go with it, because it was true. do we have any predictions?
Mine are the same. They haven't really changed.
Yeah, no, they're still the same, because we still haven't seen Teleporting Man, right?
No, we haven't.
Yeah, we still haven't seen Teleporting
Man. I'm still waiting for Teleporting Man.
I still think Grace was kidnapped by the Markovians.
Yeah.
And that's it.
That's
all I got.
All right, then moving into Side B, Lady with Gumption nominee. Drum roll.
I mean, Nora for The Flash, she did her best.
And then Inessa for Black Lightning.
And just for Black Lightning, yeah.
All right, so we have...
That was easy.
Yeah. We have Side A, we have Crazy Jane, and then we have Mia. And for Side B, we have Nora and Inessa. So...
You know I want to vote Crazy Jane.
Yeah.
Just for having the most badass introduction.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah.
Is that you?
And I think she's... I honestly think she had the most gumption, like, right out the gate. Like, her introduction had the most, like, gumption out of, like...
Yeah.
And aside from Inessa, because Inessa won last week, but I think Inessa would have been like a strong. It would have been between Crazy Jane and Inessa for me. But since Inessa won last week, I think Crazy Jane had a really like awesome introduction in Doom Patrol, and that she kind of deserves this one. So
I agree.
All right, that's unanimous. Crazy Jane for the win!
Yay!
All right, so this wraps up episode 71. As always, you can send us all your thoughts, ladieswgumption@gmail.com, or bite via Tumblr, ladieswgumption.tumblr.com. We have a Patreon again. We have a Patreon now. So patreon.com/DCTVGumption if you are feeling wonderful and generous, and we promise we will reward you soon. and we already appreciate, again, everyone who has donated. We love you. And truly, thank you. And then we will talk to you again next week about Supergirl and Doom Patrol, because all the other shows are on hiatus.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Guaranteed to be a shorter podcast.
Guaranteed. And until next time, bye.
Bye.